Hey, good morning. I'd like to call this meeting to order, please. It's 901 or no, 903. I'd like to call this board meeting to order on October 9th. So, good morning. Thank you for being with us today, both in person and online. We are here at the Central Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board meeting on August 9th, or excuse me, October 9th of 2025. This is a hybrid meeting, includes a physical meeting location here in the city of Santa Barbara at the Anapamu location in the Board of Supervisors hearing room. There's also an option for online remote participation through the Zoom webinar platform. If you'd like to watch and listen to the meeting, the Water Board's customary webcast is also available. We will be receiving information from hearing participants and public comment both in person and virtually. The Zoom meeting link has been made available along with the public speaker online request form via our agenda website meeting participation page. If you are a remote presenter or member of the public who would like to make a comment, you should already be in the Zoom webinar as an attendee using the meeting link provided on the board's website, and you should have already submitted an online speaker request form. Requests to provide comments for today's agenda will be accepted up to the start of each meeting. Excuse me, at the start of each agenda item, if you wish to comment on an item that is and have not submitted a public comment request card, please go ahead and do so now. You may also do so in person at the back of the room. If you're having trouble accessing the online meeting request link, online speaker request form, or the webcast link, please contact the clerk of the board at rb3-commentletters@waterboards.ca.gov. Remote presenters and speakers will be on mute with their cameras turned on. Once it's your time to speak, you will be asked to unmute yourself. When you're done with your comments and the board members have completed their questions, you will again be placed on mute. You're welcome to remain in the Zoom webinar as an attendee for the duration of the meeting. Exit the Zoom webinar or follow the webcast. This meeting and all Water Board meetings are recorded and available for viewing. Because this meeting is being recorded, please speak slowly and clearly. We at the Water Board would like to acknowledge that all lands and waters within the Central Coast Water Board region are unceded tribal ancestral lands and waters. We acknowledge the historical wrongdoings committed against California Native American tribes. Actions taken at this hearing and those actions throughout the Central Coast Water Board are in a hope to advance the collective goal of truth and healing. Before we take roll call, I would like to congratulate Board Member Rodriguez and Board Member Harlan on the reappointments.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And I would also like to take a moment to introduce our newest board member, Dominic Rock. And Dominic, maybe you can just take a few minutes to say hello.
Honored to join you all as members of the Central Coast Water Board. I've lived on the Central Coast for 25 years and kind of remain as inspired as ever about the landscape and the people in it. So it's really a privilege to be up here and to have an opportunity to consider all the issues that come before us concerning water quality. And I look forward to
Thank
it's
you. We're
very
really
hard to
happy to
hear,
have you.
Mr. Board Member Rock. Just
If I speak into the microphone, does it help?
That's much better. Thank you.
Thank you. May we have the roll call, please?
Chair Gray?
Here.
Vice Chair Wolf?
Here.
Member Rodriguez?
Here.
Member Hoskins?
Here.
Member Rock? Member Harlan?
Excuse me. Can we have AGP take a look at what's going on? Did we lose our board member?
I'm here.
Thank you, Member Harlan. Appreciate that. Good to see you.
Sorry. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Okay, so roll call taken. We have a quorum and we will move forward with the rest of our agenda. I'll turn it over to our executive officer, Mr. Ryan Lodge.
Thank you, Chair Gray. My name is Ryan Lodge. I'm the executive officer here at the Central Coast Water Board. I'd like to introduce our staff here today. We have our clerk to the board, Kai Johnson, sitting up front. Our assistant executive officer, Angela Schroeder, also sitting up front. To my right, we have Sophie Froelich, our legal counsel from the Office of Chief Counsel from the State Water Board. We also have our section managers, Mary Hamilton and Tamara Anderson. I'd also like to acknowledge we have our State Water Resources Control Board liaison, Sean McGuire, on today. He'll be providing an update later in the agenda. And also like to thank and acknowledge our AGP staff for providing our audiovisual services today. And that's it for staff introduction.
Thank you very much. Next item on our agenda is approval of the board meeting minutes from August. Do we have any questions, revisions, comments?
I would like to make a motion to approve the minutes from our last meeting.
Thank you. Do we have a second?
Hold second.
Thank you. May we have a roll call vote?
Chair Gray?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wolf?
Aye.
Member Rodriguez?
Aye.
Member Hoskins? Member Rock?
Stain.
Member Harlan?
Here. Yes.
Thank you. So the next item on our agenda is a report from all of us. I'm going to start to my far left today. So Board Member Rodriguez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you mentioned earlier, I was reappointed by the governor on September 15th, I believe. And the only things that I have to report is September 28th to 30th, I attended the California Association of Mutual Water Companies annual meeting in Long Beach. And on October 1st, I had my board briefing with staff. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Wolf.
Good morning, everyone. Let's see, September the 9th, I gave a brief update on the irrigated land regulatory requirements at the USDA Farm Service Agency board meeting. On September the 22nd, I hosted for Cuesta College a tour at my vineyard, emphasizing the environmental practices in the irrigation technologies to reduce water use. These are classes that I usually do about once a month. So there's a bit of a classroom setting, and then there is a walk around the vineyard showing the students various practices. Then on this month, October the 3rd, I participated at the Sacramento State Water Board Chairs and Vice Chairs meeting. And then this week on the 6th, I participated at the brief covering today's topic. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Board Member Hoskins.
Turn on your mic.
No.
That's part of it. Okay. Good morning. On October 1st, I met with Dominic Groaks, who's now our board member, to swear him in, which was quite an honor for me. So it was very nice to meet and get to know him a little bit. And then later that day, I got to have a briefing with staff and with Member Rodriguez. So it was a really nice day. On October 2nd, I had a call with Elias Rodriguez of the California Rural Legal Assistance Organization to discuss some of his concerns and their concerns ensuring access to clean water and related to the ag order. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Board Member Rock.
Yes, on the first I met with Ann Hoskins, as you just learned. And so the second half of the meeting after I was sworn in, I'm reporting on. And then on the second, I had the briefing with staff for today's agenda. That is all.
Thank you. Board Member Harlan.
Thank you. I attended the board briefing on Thursday, October 2nd, and Thank you. That's all I have to report today.
Thank you very much. Okay, so on September 25th, I had a conversation with Brandon Bolliger of the Community Water Center. On October 5th, I had a conversation with Ms. Sarah Lopez of Central Coast Water Quality Preservation, Inc. On October 6th, I attended a CAG event and a tour of agricultural properties in the Santa Maria Valley. On October 11th, I had a conversation with Natalie Herendine from Monterey Waterkeeper. On October 3rd, I attended the chairs meeting. And on October 6th, I had a call with Brandon Bolliger of the Community Water Center. That concludes my report. We will now welcome our State Board liaison, Sean McGuire, and he will provide us with his report to us.
Happy to do so. Good morning, Chair Gray and board members. Good to see you. And also good to welcome Board Member Rock to the team. Glad to have you there and appreciate your service to the state here. And congratulations to Board Member Rodriguez and Board Member Harlan on your reappointment. Really encouraged to see that, and you're glad to know that you're staying on longer with us. Sorry I couldn't be there with you. I had originally planned to be there in person with you all today down in Santa Barbara, but I just wasn't able to make that work with my calendar this time. But I thought I would do things a little bit different. Normally I go over a list of pressing issues and matters before the State Water Board, which is a very long list, as we all well know. And I could spend many hours talking about all the important issues that we're tackling. And I'm always happy to answer any questions that you have if there's anything top of mind for you. But I thought, given that we're a little past the first week in the water year, the new water year, that I could give you a little bit of an update at our board meeting. A State Water Board meeting on Tuesday this week, I had about a 2.5 hour comprehensive update on the past water year and the look ahead to the water year coming, you know, that we're in right now. So I distilled that down to hopefully just a few minutes of the top line takeaways for you all, just to give you a little bit of a sampling of what I learned about earlier this week. And I hope you find it helpful. I believe you might have a presentation that somebody submitted on my behalf. Do you have that?
I believe we do, yes.
Okay, if you could pull that up, that'd be helpful.
Can you share it on your end, or is it better for us to pull it up?
I may have the capacity to do that. Don't know. Just give me a minute. I haven't done this.
Take your time. We can see your screen, so that's a good sign.
Okay. Do you see the presentation?
We do, yes.
Okay, perfect. All right. So what you see on the screen now is the water year that we just completed. So this shows the water year.
Sean, one sec. I think you're sharing the wrong screen. We see the PowerPoint with the slides 1, 2, 3.
Okay.
Yeah, the slide that usually has notes. So if you could stop sharing, then press share again and share the screen that has your PowerPoint up on it.
Or just put it in presentation mode if you just want to click that at the bottom.
Well,
of the
I
screen.
Did.
Oh, you did.
Okay, let me try it again. See,
sorry
this
about
is,
that.
This is why this is above my pay grade. Okay.
Okay, that's perfect.
All right. Thank you for. I can't see what is happening. All right. So this, I think we all know, California has extremely dynamic and notoriously unpredictable climate conditions. It's a Mediterranean climate. It's a big geographically spread state. We have deserts and we have forest, land, mountains, and all those things, which contribute to what you see on the screen, which is a tale of a really dry, actually, Southern California. So Santa Barbara, where you are today, and south, this past year was quite dry. I believe it was about the third driest year on record and one of the warmest. But farther north, in the northern part of the state, was actually above average and quite cool. So we're fortunate with the water system we have, not to all areas, but much of the state is interconnected and able to move water from north to south and through other means. So that is helpful to help to manage the disparity that we see here in precipitation and snowfall. But overall, the year shaped out to be pretty good from a water perspective. This breaks it down a little bit more. This is the 8-station index, which is essentially the Sacramento River watershed, so Sacramento River, Feather River, and a few other streams in that area, which constitute a bulk of our water supply in the state. And it was just a little bit above average for this year. So we always like to see that blue line there is the water year that was, and that shaded light blue area is the historic average from 1991 to 2020. So the more we're either close to that line or preferably way above that line, usually the better off we are from a water supply perspective. This goes a little bit farther down the state to the San Joaquin watershed, and not quite as great a story there, but still 82% of average, so not too bad. And it's a similar story down in the southern part of the San Joaquin Basin, Tulare Lake Basin area, which was 86%. This map just shows the sort of temperature anomaly. So it's how far the average temperatures were from, the temperatures we experienced this last year were from average over the summer. And you can see here, I don't know what your experience was, but mine in Sacramento was that it was quite cool. Relatively speaking, we still had some 100 degree days, but far fewer than we had last year. So it felt like a unseasonably cool summer, which I was very grateful for. And that, I think, has helped contribute to some of the just lowering of water use generally, and just better, more favorable conditions. Because the prior two water years ago was rather wet, we were coming into this year with reservoirs that were they were in fantastic condition. In fact, most of these major reservoirs around the state filled or were at or near capacity earlier this year in the winter. And so this map shows where all of our major reservoirs are at the start of the water year here on October 1st. And the good news is, if you can see the screen, there's a green line next on each of these bars, and that's the historic average. And what you'll see is we're pretty much right at historic average for all of the major reservoirs. We, of course, need capacity available as we're entering into the wet season for flood storage. That's an important function for all of these reservoirs as well. So there's always going to be that reserve capacity until we get into the later in the water year in the spring. So this is actually a great place to start, and hopefully we'll be able to fill these up later in the year. We really can't talk about water, our water year, without taking a look underground as well. That's an important part of our resources. I know, particularly in the Central Coast, you all rely heavily upon groundwater resources. Many small communities do, also throughout the state. And we've been making a lot of progress. Had an update Tuesday at our board meeting from the Department of Water Resources in terms of the process, the progress we've been making with implementing the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act and expanding our groundwater monitoring systems statewide. And my understanding is that there's now something on the order of 9,000 monitoring wells that track groundwater levels throughout the state. So what we're seeing here is just the 1 year groundwater level change year over year. So the red, the yellow is, I think, no real significant change, so pretty static. Green is an increase, and you get into the oranges and the reds, and you start to see wells that have decreased year over year. So by and large, what you see here is a lot of yellow, some red. Kind of makes sense. The farther south you go, if surface water supplies are diminished, you're going to see what you traditionally see as a greater dependence on groundwater. This middle graph here shows the last 10 years and what we've seen. And again, I think there's really no surprise. Some of our most critically overdrafted basins down in the Tulare Lake area, which the State Water Board has been dealing with through our probationary process and through the SGMA, have continued to see long-term downward trends in groundwater levels. And that's something that the groundwater sustainability agencies I know are working hard to change the course of. And we also see some other pockets of areas, including in the Sacramento Valley, in some isolated areas where we have also seen declines in groundwater. And I won't go into this in any more detail. It's just shows the 20-year look. And it's just an example of how much information that we're gathering to show these long-term trends so we can understand how different actions and management decisions around the state are influencing groundwater levels. At the end of the day, we really want these supplies to be there available for future generations. That's what groundwater sustainability is all about. Another key part, of course, is the overpumping of groundwater can result in ground level sinking. That's called subsidence. And I just thought this was interesting, so I wanted to show this to you. But this shows the areas, the hotspot areas, like in Tulare, which is no surprise, the area where we've been seeing long-term trends in groundwater level declining is the area where we've seen the most subsidence as well. But one thing that's happened, if you look at water year over to the right-hand side of the screen, water year 2023 and 2024, the blue is actually... So red is bad. Red means ground level sinking. Blue means it's actually rising and that there's uplift. And that was something I wasn't even aware was a possibility until these last couple of years. But I'm encouraged to see that during the wetter, an average stronger water year seasons, we've been seeing subsidence slow down dramatically. So hopefully we can continue that trend going forward. And I think this is the last slide on groundwater, but we're all aware, and I know in the Central Coast area and in the San Joaquin Valley in particular, during droughts, we see numerous domestic wells run dry, unfortunately, and work hard to have a system in place to be able to provide support to those community members that are impacted by drought and dry wells. And you can see on the bar chart here, in 2015, around that time, and also in 2021, when we were at the peak of the last couple of droughts, that's where we saw the most concern and the most folks experiencing dry wells during those times. The last couple of years, that's really tapered off because groundwater levels have recovered or stabilized in many areas, so that's encouraging to see. Shifting gears from groundwater now to urban water use. So this is just another topic. And what I wanted to show here, the main takeaway is that as a state, when we think about all of our urban, our municipal, commercial, industrial water use in cities predominantly, we're doing fairly well. That big bold black line shows our urban water use as reported as compared to recent water years. And we're trending on the lower end. It doesn't go quite as low as folks were able to do during the 2014-15 drought, but we're heading in the right direction there. And you'll recall we recently adopted making conservation a California way of life regulations. And I think we continue to see communities responding to the need to use water efficiently and encouraged to see that. So that was the year that was, and now it's the time for the crystal ball and trying to figure out what is the year to, the water year to come going to be for us all. And spoiler alert, we don't know, as is usually the case at this time of the year. But these slides were shared with us by the state climatologist, Dr. Michael Anderson with Department of Water Resources. And he pointed out a couple of things here. One is that this is ocean temperatures over the past month. And if you look at that red blob next to between Asia and the West Coast, you can see it's been abnormally warm in the ocean waters over the past month or so, which he pointed out was quite unusual to see and did raise some concerns about potential changes to the jet stream and affecting the path of storm systems as they move towards the United States. I already this talks again about the water year that was, and I already discussed a little bit about how it was more dry in Southern California than the northern part of the state. This shows it though in a different way, which is that all of the major atmospheric river systems that hit the state this past year, what you can see here is all the arrows. Those are each one's a different atmospheric river. They all essentially hit north of Monterey Bay, and up and then up into the Pacific Northwest. So that certainly tells the story about why most of the precipitation was seen up there. But it's notable that really no atmospheric rivers hit the southern part of the state. So the concern about we're in the La Nina pattern, that's the projection for this year. The concern with that, as it was shared with me, is that we could get a high pressure system that pushes the jet stream up, and that causes most of the storms that we do receive to go up north, far north of California, and that could create drying conditions in the state potentially. I've seen charts that show, we always worry, is it El Nino? Is it La Nina? You know, what does that mean? Is it a guarantee that we're going to be in a drought? And the answer is no. We've had La Nina years that have been wet. We've had La Nina years that have been dry. So it can go either direction still. And that's what we see here. This is the seasonal precipitation outlook provided by NOAA. And if you look at the left-hand side is the temperature outlook for the next 3 months through December. And you can see it's projected to be warmer than average. But then when you look at the seasonal precipitation outlook here, most of California doesn't have a color to it, which means it has equal chances of being above normal or below normal. So I read that to be inconclusive. So that's where we are, which is really no surprise at this point of the water year. This next slide, though, shows a little bit of a farther outlook for January, February, and March. And I'll just point you to the seasonal precipitation outlook on the right, which shows a projection for below average precipitation conditions projected for the southern part of the state. So again, with the conditions that they're projecting and a little bit of what I showed you, I think tells the story as to why we're seeing that. And this is really the December through February kind of time frame is really the critical part, the critical months where we hope to see the most precipitation and hopefully a good strong development of a snowpack. So we'll see. And what I can offer is we get periodic updates on hydrologic conditions at board meetings, and so maybe in a future board meeting a little bit next year, in the early part of maybe January or so, I can come back and give you an update as to how things are shaping up for this water year. Anyway, that is what I wanted to share with you today. So I hope you find that helpful. And as always, I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Board Member McGuire. Really happy to have you here, and I very much appreciate that that thorough presentation. I will open it up to my board colleagues for questions or comments. Yes.
Yeah, so, very valuable presentation because it It takes water to grow plants. And, you know, one of the changes that have been observed, particularly in the Central Coast, you know, in addition to temperatures and precipitation, are the wind patterns. And this year, 2025, the winds have consistently been a lot more significant. And when you talk about agriculture, wind is one of the factors that impacts evaporation and transpiration. So I just wanted to mention that that's becoming another important factor when we look at what is happening to our weather patterns.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great flag for sure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Board Member Harlan.
Thank you. That was very, very interesting, Sean. And some good news in some of those slides that things are getting a little bit better and we'll see what happens this year. But I really appreciate getting that overall picture of the state of water in California and precipitation and the groundwater, especially information is good. So thank you very much. Appreciate sure. it.
Yeah. And I think to your point, it's yes, we've had a fortuitous couple of years, but one thing that I've experienced in my time here on the board is that it doesn't take a lot to find ourselves back in the throes of a drought again. You know, it could be just one, this year could be incredibly dry and then we're back in it, struggling to manage our water. So it's important to stay vigilant here.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions? Thank you, Mr. McGuire. I really appreciated the update on Sigma. It's really good to hear that we're seeing subsiding. That's very helpful. But I think this was just an excellent perspective for us statewide and ultimately just on the Pacific Coast in terms of your overview. So appreciate you being here with us today and providing us with the informational PowerPoint.
Great. Good to see you all. Take care.
Likewise. Take good care. Thank you. Okay, the next item on our agenda is our public forum. We do have a request to speak on the public forum from a person called Kiss the Comedian. They would like to provide comment via YouTube, which we do not, we don't have the ability to. Oh, you're right here. Okay, great. So you can have 3 minutes. Okay, and if you want to come to the dais, you can have 3 minutes. May we have 3 minutes on the clock, please? It's on, yeah. If you just hold for a minute while we have 3 minutes. Thank you.
Technical difficulties.
Go ahead. I'll start timing. Go ahead. You can. Your 3 minutes starts now. Thank you.
Oh, when you go. Okay. I just want to say, God bless the United States of America. God bless Donald Trump. Rest in peace to Charlie Kirk. Died an American hero. I was going to make a suggestion that we can build a statue of Charlie Kirk at the University of Santa Barbara, California. There's like a special forum. You know, I'm a Black Republican here in Santa Barbara. People avoid me like the Passover. You know, I didn't kill any Egyptian babies. Maybe next time put a blood on your door so, you know, God will go over. I just want to say, you know, people avoid me like dirty water. And I just want to say you guys are doing great. Thanks for everything you guys do. And my dream is to have the biggest podcast in the world, the Fourth Quarter Podcast with Jerry Jones and the Dallas Cowboys. I'm a Cowboy fan, America's team. And my dream is like to have a bunch of A-list celebrities like Oprah, Costner, flying a helicopter into AT&T Stadium and interview them with Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders and talk about their life and stuff. I think that would be a great podcast once a week after Monday Night Football. And I just want to say you guys are doing great. Thanks for everything that you guys do.
Thank you for your comment. I do not have any other speaker cards for public forum, so we will move on to the next agenda item, which is item number 7. Mr. Lodge?
Thank you, Chair Gray. Item 7 is consideration of revised waste discharge requirements and water reclamation requirements for Monterey 1 Pure Water Monterey Project. Pure Water Monterey is a groundwater replenishment project that has been in operation, injecting purified water into the Seaside Basin to augment local domestic water supplies since 2020. This permit reflects an expansion of the initial project to increase both the production of purified water and its injection into the basin. Christina Olmos and Rachel Hone of our staff will provide a summary of the permit and the staff report.
Thank you, Ryan, and good morning, Chair Gray and members of the board. As Ryan said, I am Rachel Hone. I am an engineering geologist in the Waste Discharge Requirements Unit. I'm here with my colleague, Christina Olmos. She is a water resource control engineer in the Recycled Water Program. And without further ado, we will go into our presentation on the waste discharge and water reclamation requirements for the Pure Water Monterey Expansion Project. Thank you for your patience through our technical.
No worries, it's completely fine. We haven't been in this room in a while, so it's all good.
Yeah, to outline our presentation today, we're going to give you an overview of the project, give you a snapshot of the regulatory and permit framework. We'll go over the compliance history thus far and discuss the public outreach that was performed for the permit in front of you today. And finally, we'll give you our staff recommendation. All right. Pure Water Monterey is an indirect potable reuse project, also referred to as IPR. These projects are regulated under California Code of Regulation, Title 22, Division 4, Chapter 3, Article 5.2, Indirect Potable Reuse for Groundwater Replenishment. PR is a treatment cycle that turns wastewater into a safe, reliable drinking water source. It starts when wastewater, sometimes combined with industrial or stormwater flows, is sent to a treatment plant. From there, water goes through advanced purification to remove pollutants and pathogens. The purified water is then injected into a groundwater basin, which acts as a natural safety barrier. The basin adds dilution, provides additional treatment, and most importantly, gives at least 4 months to detect and fix any issues before this water reaches the drinking water supply. Finally, the water is pumped back out, treated once again by the drinking water provider, and delivered to homes and businesses where it restarts the cycle. Monterey One is one of the largest producers of recycled water in our region. The advanced purification facility is shown here in the red roofs. The project's first permit was adopted in 2017, and the injections began in February of 2020. For decades, the Monterey Peninsula relied heavily on pumping from the Carmel River, but cease and desist orders have required those diversions to be drastically reduced to protect the river's riparian habitat and endangered steelhead. This mandate created a regional need to replace the lost supplies, which has driven agencies to look into sustainable alternatives like water recycling. So I'm going to start with an overview of the project and describe how it fits in with the broader portfolio of regional recycled water and groundwater replenishment efforts, and then focus more closely on the specific components of the project before you today. So here we have a map with Moss Landing to the north and Monterey to the south. Monterey One Water's regional treatment plant and the advanced water purification facility is here in the center. So Monterey One Water is the regional wastewater utility for Monterey County. They collect and treat domestic, commercial, and industrial wastewater, as well as stormwater from communities across Monterey Peninsula and northern Salinas Valley. The service area is shown here in green, with these gray areas indicating flow towards the treatment plants. Monterey One Water operates the 29 million gallon per day regional wastewater treatment plant, and secondary treated effluent from that facility is conveyed to the advanced water purification facility, where it undergoes advanced treatment. The purified recycled water is then conveyed through the city of Marina, where it's injected into the seaside groundwater basin. The treatment process creates a waste stream, reverse osmosis concentrate, which is discharged through Monterey One's existing ocean outfall. That's this line here. The regional wastewater treatment plant and the ocean outfall are permitted under a separate NPDES permit, which was adopted by the board in December of 2024. And the additional flows from the advanced water purification facility were considered in the updated NPDES permit. You'll also notice other recycled water projects on this map up here, this area circled in purple. Monterey One Water provides non-potable recycled water for agricultural irrigation. This is the Castroville Seawater Intrusion Project, or CSIP, which is permitted independently. And for more information on CSIP, you can refer to the permit fact sheet. So now that we've seen where the project's located and how Monterey One Water operates in the region, we can take a closer look at the same project in process flow, starting with wastewater collection, moving through treatment, and ultimately returning to our drinking water supply. Wastewater from homes, businesses, local industry, and stormwater is collected and sent to Monterey One Water's regional treatment plant for secondary treatment. From there, the treated effluent serves two major recycled water projects. It supplies agricultural irrigation through the Castroville Seawater Intrusion Project, and it's delivered to the Advanced Water Purification Facility. At the purification facility, water undergoes advanced treatment. Currently, about 600 acre feet per year of this purified water is provided to the Marina Coast Water District for landscape irrigation or other future uses, and the remainder is injected into the seaside groundwater basin. As I showed on the last slide, the reverse osmosis concentrate from the treatment facilities is sent to the ocean outfall. And while overall the system is complex and water can flow to several different destinations, today we're focusing on the advanced purified water that's injected into the seaside groundwater basin, where it's stored underground until it's pumped out later as part of our potable water supply. The permit in front of you today captures the expanded project and builds upon Monterey One Water's initial project. Treatment capacity is being increased from 50 million gallons per day to, 5 million gallons per day to 7.6 million gallons per day. Monterey One Water has added new treatment components to treat the increased flows. This includes additional membrane, reverse osmosis, and UV advanced oxidation components. The injection capacity into the seaside groundwater basin is also being expanded from 3,700 acre feet per year to 5,950 acre feet per year. To support this increase, two additional deep injection wells have been installed along DIW-5 and DIW-6, along with backflush basins to manage well maintenance and operations. The key to making this project work is advanced treatment, the multiple stages that take already treated wastewater and polish it to drinking water quality. This slide shows the advanced water purification process, also called the treatment train. This process is prescribed under Title 22 of California's recycled water requirements. So the key point here is that this is the same treatment train used in the initial project. Water first goes through ozone pretreatment, then membrane filtration, followed by reverse osmosis, and finally ultraviolet light with advanced oxidation. Together, these processes remove organics, pathogens, salts, and trace contaminants. The result is purified water that is safe, consistent, and protective of water quality objectives and public health. From there, the water is recharged into the groundwater basin, where it must remain for a required residence time. This environmental buffer provides added protection before water is later extracted for potable use. This is a photo of one of Monterey One Water's deep injection wells. This is DIW-4. There are 6 deep injection wells and a network of downgradient monitoring wells. Monitoring wells play a critical role in this project. After going through the advanced treatment stages, the purified water is injected hundreds of feet underground into the seaside groundwater basin, and the monitoring wells track how the injected water moves, confirms that it's meeting the required residence time, and makes sure that groundwater quality is protected. So to talk more about the broader environmental and community benefits of this project, we like to think of these in 4 categories: surface water, water supply, water quality, and community resilience. So first, the surface riparian benefits. Carmel River used to supply water to the area, and by reducing reliance on the Carmel River and other surface water bodies, this project helps restore river flows and protect sensitive habitats, including those that support threatened and endangered species. Second, the water supply benefits. Pure Water Monterey provides a reliable, drought-resistant local supply. And instead of letting highly treated water flow out to the ocean, Monterey One Water is reusing it as a sustainable resource for the region. This is especially important on the Monterey Peninsula, where water shortages are chronic due to limits on the Carmel River pumping and overdraft in the Seaside Basin. Third, water quality. The injected water meets or exceeds drinking water standards and in fact is often lower in salts than native groundwater. This means that over time it can help improve the quality of water in the basin. And finally, community resilience. This project supports long-term water security for Monterey Peninsula, which is critical in times of drought. It also advances environmental justice by providing a safe, locally controlled water to all residences in the service area, including historically underserved communities. So now to pivot and talk about our regulatory and permit framework. This slide highlights the key regulatory elements that guide how an indirect potable reuse project is designed, permitted, and operated. On the left, you'll see the plans and policies that were implemented through this permit. Things like the basin plan, which set water quality objectives, the statewide recycled water policy, the water code, and Title 22 regulations that establish treatment and monitoring criteria for potable reuse. Now moving to the right, are the technical demonstrations a discharger, or in this case, Monterey One Water, is required to perform. These include an anti-degradation assessment, the Title 22 engineering report, groundwater modeling, tracer studies, and source control programs. Moving further to the right, these come together as the permit in front of you today, which includes standards and monitoring tools. Staff review all this information, prepare the permit conditions, which Christina will talk about in just a moment. All of these elements work together with ongoing oversight and compliance to ensure accountability, transparency, and above all, long-term protection of water quality and public health. And with that, I will hand the presentation over to my colleague, Christina.
Thank you, Rachel. Again, I'm Christina Olmos, and my position is staff engineer in the Recycle Water Program and this is a newer position in our office. Part of my job is to help with the regulatory coordination for all of our recycled water projects. So we don't prepare these recycled water permits alone. We closely coordinate with the State Water Board Division of Drinking Water, or DDW. So I wanted to provide a little background on our role versus DDW's role. Big picture, DDW authors Title 22 Recycled Water Regulations. DDW also reviews and comments on Title 22 engineering reports. They confirm projects comply with the regulations and are protective of public health and drinking water. Once an engineering report is deemed final, DDW prepares a conditional acceptance letter. This contains limits and operational and monitoring requirements. DDW's conditions are then included in a water board permit. So Central Coast Water Board staff author and issue recycled water permits or orders, and they include requirements that are protective of both public health and groundwater. We do compliance, including inspections and enforcement. And we're lead staff, but we continue to coordinate with DDW on all the projects. So we closely worked with DDW to prepare the permit that is in front of you today.
Christina, may we interrupt you just briefly?
Yeah.
Thank you very much. And you may be getting to this. When you talk about the public health element of it, and it, you know, appears like we're really the ones focused on compliance, how frequently are we testing? Is it us or is it the drinking water division that's just testing the water that's going to be used for potable human use? And how do we let the community understand that that is good water, safe water, et cetera? Thanks.
Good question. So we prepare an extensive monitoring and reporting program where we look at the effluent as it's leaving the wastewater treatment plant. And then there's required groundwater monitoring, which Rachel said earlier, just down gradient of the injection wells. So that operates depending on results, but they are collecting samples monthly, quarterly for all the constituents that are listed in the permit. And then DDW has oversight of the drinking water. So at that point, we kind of hand it over to DDW, and there's monitoring that occurs at the extraction wells. And now those are overseen by the entities that are supplying the recycled water. I don't know the frequencies of those offhand.
Yeah, no, that's right. I just, you know, think, and I'm sure you're getting, you have very extensive reporting here, so it's great. You know, just to make sure if the public wanted to understand as time went on, you know, how we were, all the work that we're doing to make sure that, you know, this is safe and improved water, I think that's helpful, you know.
There's, DDW has a database that includes all of the monitoring data that's publicly accessible, and we actually do too. So we have a GeoTracker database, and all the data that Monterey One Water is collecting is posted publicly to that website. So over the past couple of years, we've been working hard to get all our data accessible. What is out there?
Thanks a lot.
So now I'm gonna jump into what is within the order. So first we have findings. This is the background and legal authority. Next we have the order limitations. So these include the AWPF flow limit, total injection flow limits into the groundwater basin, and limits on individual injection wells. There are also effluent limits. So these are set at the drinking water standards, or MCLs, or basin plan water quality objectives, whichever are lower. Then there are limits on pollutants in receiving groundwater, and these are set at the same limits as the effluent. There are also process limitations. So these are limits across specific treatment units like the RO system. And then there's pathogen reduction requirements. Next, there's discharge prohibitions and general requirements related to operation and monitoring, notification, things like don't spill. And then the order includes the water reclamation requirements. And these are contained in attachment D. These are a copy of DDW's conditions from their most recent engineering report conditional acceptance letter. The order also states that if DDW revises their conditional acceptance letter in the future, our executive officer can update attachment D accordingly. This order also includes a robust monitoring and reporting program, and it lists process, influent, effluent, and groundwater monitoring locations and frequencies, constituent of emergent concern and notification level monitoring and reporting requirements. And then finally, we have a fact sheet, and this is explains the why behind the requirements and gives more background on the project. So next, I'm going to provide an overview of compliance. But first, we wanted to emphasize that the AWPF has run almost every day since startup. It's averaged about 3.3 million gallons per day, and over the past couple of years has run at capacity of 5 million gallons per day. So there's been a total of about 18,000 acre feet of water produced. This photo shows the main control room with the operator viewing the SCADA system. So they have 24/7 staffing and monitoring at the plant with lots of continuous monitoring. So there's hundreds of data points collected monthly. Monterey One Water also participates in a quarterly Peninsula Water Operations meeting. They review injection flow and water quality with other seaside groundwater basin stakeholders. This helps Monterey One confirm compliance with residents' time and improves communication with everyone involved. So first on this photo, on the left side, you can see the membrane filtration inside of the AWPF facility. And on the right is the RO system. So all of these processes have monitors and continuous monitoring. Regarding compliance, Monterey One has submitted all monthly, quarterly, and annual reports on time. They are complete. They've generally had exceptional performance of the treatment system. There have been no effluent violations or pathogen removal violations. At startup, they reported some RO treatment process violation and had detections of arsenic in groundwater monitoring wells. Both were promptly investigated and addressed, and they have shown continuous compliance since. There's been 5 minor sampling errors reported for missing a hold time, but overall, we have a lot of data and no significant compliance concerns. Next, I'll talk briefly about our public outreach. So on April 10th, Monterey One Water held a public hearing. Stakeholders and interested parties were able to comment on the project's Title 22 engineering report. So the report contains all the expanded project details. Water Board and DDW staff were in attendance, and there were no significant comments received. On July 23rd, Central Coast Water Board posted this proposed order for public comment and emailed the interested parties. It included all regulatory agencies involved, cities that discharge to the system, nearby well owners, water management districts, environmental groups in Monterey County. And on July 24th, we also sent individual letters to tribes with potential interest or connection to the affected lands and waters, provide them with a 30-day public comment period. We did not receive any comments from the tribes. On August 22nd, we did receive comments from Marina Coast Water District, or MCWD, and Monterey One Water. The comments and our responses are included in Attachment 2 of the staff report. Recall that Marina Coast Water District uses some of the advanced treated water for landscape irrigation under a separate permit. So in their comments, they clarified their role, project responsibilities, and commented on use allocations. So we updated the permit to address many of their comments and clarified which entity owns which components of the distribution system, and confirmed use allocations are not prescribed in our permit, and committed to working with Marina Coast to address some of their comments in their use permit. Monterey One Water also submitted comments on pH sampling, which we addressed. And they requested to increase permitted flow for 2 deep injection wells. So this comment required some follow-up discussions with Water Board and DDW staff. And in those discussions, Monterey One more clearly explained the groundwater pumping and extraction scenarios in the Seaside Basin that were presented in the engineering report appendices. So this supported that the wells could operate at higher flows and still be in compliance with the Title 22 requirements. So DDW updated their conditional acceptance letter on August 28th with changes to the two individual wells. And then we in turn updated attachment D. So on September 3rd, we held a short second public comment period to allow the public to review the changes to attachment D. We received one letter from Monterey One Water in support of the change. So next I'll provide our staff recommendation. This proposed permit ensures continued protection of human health and beneficial uses of groundwater and allows Monterey One Water to expand a successful IPR project that improves water supply resiliency. Today, we are asking the board to adopt R3-2025-0008. This will terminate the 2017 permit. The board also has the option to adopt the order with changes or not adopt the order at this time, and the existing permit would remain in effect. Finally, we want to say thank you. This is a very large and complex project. So we wanted to extend our thanks to everyone listed here and other stakeholders that have made it possible. There are only about 9 IPR projects in California, so we're really excited to have this project on the Central Coast. And this is a photo of Monterey One Water, their staff and consultants with DDW and Water Board staff inside the treatment facility at a recent inspection. We wanted to particularly thank DDW, who really helped our staff prepare this permit, and previous Water Board staff permit writer, James Bishop, who helped draft the permit. So thank you. And if you have any questions, you can start with that.
Thank you, Ms. Hose. Thank you, Ms. Hone. Mr. Lodge.
Yeah, I don't know if we mentioned that there is a supplemental sheet for this item. Just so board's aware, it should be in your folder. And it just relates to the approval acceptance letter from the Division of Drinking Water. There was an old reference in the permit or in the order that we had to update for the more recent August approval.
I'm not sure which folder.
That folder, it's also online. The supplemental sheet is also online.
It was sent out.
Okay, there was nothing in this folder, but it's what we saw.
Yeah, it was sent out, I think, earlier this week as an announcement.
Thank you for that. Yes, Vice Chair Wolf.
So thank you for, the presentation. One of the questions I have ties back to the earlier presentation from our State Water Board liaison looking at water years. You know, it's very clear when we look in recent years, some major variation in some of our climatic activities, level of precipitation, et cetera. You know, last permit was 2017, fast forward with 2025. So when looking at, this existing facility, have we refreshed our review of the ability of the facility to manage climate change? Meaning, extreme precipitation events. And as you're well aware, many water treatment facilities within our region have had time to time kind of readjust a little bit, their approach to prevent flooding of the facility, et cetera. So that's my first question. If you could comment on the adequacy as part of this new permit, based on the history of significant weather events.
Take that one. My name is Lee Lemoyne. I'm the senior resource water resource control engineer at the Central Coast Water Board and manage that recycled water program. So the answer to that is yes, and you might remember from last year when we brought the NPDES permit to you for approval, which also includes the expanded RO volume. There are provisions in that permit that require the facility to take a look at what will be the hazards related to climate change over the next X amount of years, and how will that impact the ability to continue to provide the level of treatment that it prevents. So it's something that we worked with Monterey One with at that time and felt pretty very confident that they're well ahead of the curve in terms of planning way out in the future. The facility itself, from my understanding, isn't under a strong risk of flooding necessarily, but they're also doing a lot of planning related to energy resiliency, backup power, creating generating power on site through various ways. So I think that they're strong in that regard.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, I was part of the field trips visiting the facility, and I pretty much knew the answer. However, I think it's important for the public to be able to articulate this, because you know there are certain things we know, we've seen it, but it's not a given because you know it's not in writing. So you know where we do have this little section about climate impact, you know, that was not articulated. So that's why I wanted to reemphasize that point. My next question, and you touched base on it, is, you know, the uptime and reliability of a facility, which ties to how robust of a backup system you have, you know, the concept of islanding, which I know they have looked at with, you know, solar supplementing the facility with solar energy. However, there's another aspect which increasingly is being shown to be a big concern, and that's the aspect of cybersecurity. We may say, hey, we're the Water Quality Control Board, Jean-Pierre, you're way out of your swim lane. I will say I'm not, because when you look at our regulations, there's actually some sections which do require, for example, with variable frequency drives, to have the software which does have no firewalls and you know, security built in. And when you take a very complex facility like this one, yes, because it's an indirect potable reuse, you know, we have 120 days of residency, so if we had a whoops, we can address it, unlike direct potable reuse. But still, you know, when you're looking at a system like these, we take this to a whole new level. So again, looking at 2027 permits and equipment, fast forward 2025, you know, I don't have to, I think, convince anyone that when you look at the news, this is a big topic. So as part of our due diligence, and I know this is a little bit more on the specificity of the technical aspect, but nevertheless, it is part of our regulations. Could you comment on this a little bit?
Happy to, and I won't say that cybersecurity is something that we address head on in our permits, but I think it's evident in the image that Christine and Rachel showed on the in their control room. So much of the process is automated. It's extremely high tech, and so yes, important. I can't speak to Monterey One's cybersecurity. We do have Paul Sciuto, Executive Officer of Monterey One Water, so he may be able to touch on it. But just in terms of the indirect potable reuse project, and there is a level of protection in that there's many levels of alarming built into the system. And so if there's any detection that there's off-spec water, that water is not put into the production water pipeline and not injected. So there's a lot of redundancy built into the alarming system. And actually, last month, Susan, who we have online, Susan Brownstein from DDW, our colleague who helped us with this permit for the drinking water side, and Christina and Rachel joined Susan to do the testing of that alarming system and verify that it works, it is working, and it has been and it will continue to. So.
Well, if my, excuse me, if my memory serves me right, I think there was also a consideration of enhancing the fiber optic system, communication system. And, you know, a lot of facilities are trying to move away from Wi-Fi connections, which can be more easily manipulated versus a fiber optic communication system. And I think there was one project that was in the works. Why? Because Homeland Security had visited the facility and had pointed out that this could be a significant enhancement. I mentioned these things again. Some of it I'm familiar with. So you say, are you asking a question, Jean-Pierre, or are you just making a statement? But again, I think it's important for the public at large to understand that, you know, there's a lot of behind the scene other activities taking place to take, you know, all the different aspects of reliability, security, particularly as we, you know, talk about drinking water systems and, you know, above and beyond the, you know, the fact we inject it and, you know, we got 120 days to figure out what's going on, but still.
I just wanted to add, I think that is a great point. And this permit does require the discharger comply with our WDR standard provisions. And we do have a requirement in standard provisions that if there's SCADA, they, you know, must protect the system. So I don't think it's out too far outside the lane and something we've thought about in the past for all of our wastewater systems.
All right. Well, thank you for the opportunity to add a little bit more light on that particular aspect of infrastructures of complex systems. Thank you.
Thank you. Board Member Rodriguez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the great presentation. I have a couple of questions for you. The first one is regarding the deep injection wells. Is there redundancy, for instance, if one of the wells were to go down due to failure or for maintenance, will the other five wells be able to produce more water, and are they permitted? Is there a requirement from a permitting standpoint for that?
Take this. So there are six injection wells, and then there are a separate set of extraction wells. And yes, on both sides. So Monterey One, there are individual limits on each well, but there's a lot of variability in terms of how they operate operationally, kind of when and how much they put within those individual limits. And my understanding is that the well limits individually, the individual well limits provide enough operational flexibility that Monterey One does from day to day have flexibility to say, we're going to put more here versus here. And on the extraction side, for CalAM, I can't speak to how the how CalAM diversifies within their well field, but I know that they're building two more extraction wells within the next year. I'm sorry, yes, extraction wells. And so that's going to increase their alternative supply possibilities and also increase their operational flexibility in terms of where they can extract wells water from. So.
And a quick follow-up question on that. We toured the facility about a year and a half ago, if I remember correctly, and I really enjoyed it. And one of the things that I forget, and I know this was asked and answered there, is all the water produced injected, or is some of it piped to various water agencies?
Just to clarify, we visited the Pure Water SoCal facility.
No, we visited Monterey One about a year and a half ago.
A while ago. I think it was longer than that. But yes, I mean, SoCal was about a year and a half ago. Monterey One was probably right after you joined the board. But it's been a while.
It was my first meeting, I think.
Yes. Yeah, it possibly could have been. Yeah.
So 3 years.
The answer is yes. There's the water from the purified water that is produced at the advanced water purification facility goes either to the injection wells, or it goes to the injection wells, and then a portion of it is sort of peeled off to Marina Coast Water District for their use.
And my last question, I know that this is an expensive technology treatment, you know, recycled water in general, and we need a lot more of it, is my opinion in California. But one of the benefits, or one of the statements made was that it benefits vulnerable communities. Now, and I know it does that from a supply standpoint, but from a cost standpoint, I don't see that in my in my brain. Now, if it does, it does. But I know that, again, you know, it's an expensive technology. The city of Santa Barbara, for instance, with their desal facility, they resell that water like $4,200 an acre foot, when groundwater is about $700 an acre foot, give or take. So I imagine that the technology is somewhat similar, or the costs. So I just don't see, from an economic standpoint, how it can benefit, or it does benefit, you know, vulnerable, low-income communities, with the exception of obviously being a clean source of drinking water. And if there's anything that you can share on that, and I know that that's not our purview, but it's still, it's something that I'm interested in knowing. Thank you.
Sure. It's highly relevant. We're thinking a little bit broader on that one versus dollar for dollars. What is the cost of this supply versus other ways to create a new source of drinking water? Expanding an existing project over, say, creating something new or different. Also, the downstream effects of a new water supply and the opportunities it affords to communities in terms of economic growth and housing costs. And so it overall economically is beneficial.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions or comments from my board colleagues? Yes, Board Member Rock.
Thanks for the presentation. It was excellent. I had a question about how the expanded capacity at the advanced treatment plant affects Monterey One or the regional facility. Is there any increase in influence that they are trying to address through expanding the advanced treatment? Or is it, I know they're separate, permitted separately, but is it one of the drivers for this project, an interest in just peeling off more influent in effect from, or allowing the regional facility to take more influent from, say, stormwater facilities and other potential sources of wastewater?
Over the past few years, there's been additional source waters that have been able to hook up. So the city of Salinas, like you described, they have now stormwater that can be diverted to this project and into the regional treatment plant. And then there's industrial process water from the city of Salinas that can now be pumped in. So I think big picture, that is a component of allowing this or having this expansion occur, is there are other sources that are coming in.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Board Member Harlan, anything you'd like to share?
No, thank you very much. I think it's a really interesting project. And they've been at it for a few years, and I applaud them for that. And I really get excited about these agencies planning for the future. And I think that seems like that's what we all need to be doing more of, as much as we can. And I have not visited this facility, but I can in the future because it's fairly close to me. So I'd love to see it in person. Thank you.
Thank you, Board Member Harlan. Vice Chair Wolf.
Thank you. And just wanted to, you know, share that my colleague's observation regarding the cost of the water, I think, is a valid one, because it ultimately gets to the affordability of the water to the ratepayers. And I think to exemplify that, you know, and when I read all of the comment letters, one of them was actually pointing out the cost of the reporting to a regional water board that was estimated at $500,000 a year. And, you know, expressed concerns over these costs just to provide a report, not, you know, even touching base on the O&M, operation and maintenance of a facility. I did ask that question. I brought it up when we had the brief, and, you know, staff did share with me that as time goes by and we're looking at the records of compliance, some of these requirements down the road can be further reduced. But, you know, I wanted to echo, you know, your comment is that that's, I think that's something to keep in mind. And again, it's not exactly within our swim lane, you know, to address what's the impact of the ratepayers. But, you know, when we look at these very large complex systems, you know, I think when we think of sustainability, one aspect of sustainability is the economic sustainability of a project. And that was one of the questions I had asked our staff as well is, you know, it takes a pretty strong financial position to be able to, you know, manage projects like these. And I was reassured that, you know, all the financial requirements to meet the financial obligation of operating a facility of this complexity, you know, are met. So anyway, thank you for bringing that up.
I appreciate the recognition on that. And just two things that came to mind is, you know, we're trying to help people that have groundwater issues with 123 TCP, and you know, there's an issue there, and you know, the human right to water. If it's a right, then why is it so expensive? And I'm not saying on this project, but overall. And I think it was Thomas Jefferson who called it part of the commons. But yeah, you know, and it's not Monterey One's fault, nor the city of Santa Barbara, nor, you know, Salinas. It's just, it is what it is, and it's a concern. Thank you.
Thanks. I want to echo that as well. I do have a question then. So I imagine that the cost recovery and rates are set by the CPUC. Is that right? Is that where the, like, where is the cost recovery of this project?
Yeah, this is
a rate payer.
Right. Yeah. This is a little bit beyond the scope of our permitting and our staff's ability to answer some of these questions. Unfortunately, we could ask Monterey One to provide some input on that, but the cost associated with the project is not something I think our staff is going to be able to.
Yeah, no, I'm not asking about the cost. I'm just asking, is it the Board of Public Utilities Commission, and has this been approved? Or
I believe
we can wait. I mean, Paul will have an opportunity to answer questions. So, Mr. Shuto is sitting in the audience right there. He loves this facility, and I'm sure he's going to be brimming with all kinds of information. So, once we close this section of the meeting, I'm happy to open it up for questions to him. I would like to make some comments before we do that.
Well, just before you do, though, yes, that'll be very helpful. If, I'm just wondering if it's actually gone through all the other approvals that are related to this. But I do think because we do make a point about this being supportive of the human rights of water and also for disadvantaged communities, that we make sure that, that we understand kind of what that impact is, or maybe we don't make such a conclusive statement. I think obviously having access to the water is important, but I do think I agree with Board Member Rodriguez that affordability is certainly an element of this, you know, as we support these technological improvements. And I also find the question on cybersecurity very relevant just for what we're seeing around other energy systems right now. And so I know that's outside the scope pretty much of what we're trying to look at, but I would just encourage, I am sure there are other agencies within the state that are very focused on cyber for critical facilities, and hopefully maybe just to get concurrence that they're aware of this project and that this is also on their radar, I think would be really important. So I'm really glad that Vice Chair brought that up.
Thank you. So thanks so much for the presentation. I think it was really excellent. I'll just provide my comments on affordability. I mean, I think that we're faced
globally with affordability issues on access to safe, clean, and affordable water. This is a global problem. And we always, we understand there's the economics at stake. We had at our last board meeting the alternative water supply discussion, and that took economists into consideration. However, I think for this, there is some nuance in terms of the statement that you made related to access to clean water for underserved communities. Obviously, there are constraints on the Mono Peninsula with access to water, longstanding, decades-long access to water. So any new water source is going to carry with it, I think, a price tag, unfortunately. And I'll also just state, you know, the United States hasn't always planned and paid for water in its water systems nationally. That's a huge issue that we have. But I understand sort of the balance point you're trying to strike there in terms of the access. I personally am extremely excited about this project. I think it's honestly a triumph, taking so many sources of water, chemistry associated with all these different inputs, and bringing it to a place where it can be injected and then placed back onto the community, I think is really just wonderful. And again, reusing every single drop of the water that we have to that reuse point is amazing. So I think, you know, the questions and the discussion about affordability are really valid points, but I do think there's some nuance there to discuss. If we don't have anything further, I'd like to turn to public comment. Okay, so our first speaker, Mr. Paul Sciuto.
Thank you, Chair Gray, members of the board, and staff. My name is Paul Sciuto. I'm the executive officer of Monterey One Water, and thank you very much for the time to speak on our project. So, of course, I prepared some stuff, but I think I'm more intrigued, if appropriate, to try to respond to some of the questions, which are excellent. So, obviously, we are here, I am here, to express our full support in adoption of this order. And I did want to point out that the adoption of this is one step towards potentially addressing the cease and desist order that's been in place on the Monterey Peninsula for many years. So this is certainly one step in a historic moment. In no particular order, is it okay if I try to address some questions?
Go ahead.
Okay, since the cost was the first one, recycled water is expensive. It absolutely is. I had the good fortune of seeing your desal plant here in Santa Barbara yesterday, and costs are, like you said, in the range of $4,200 up to $5,000 an acre foot. Our water, it's about $4,300 an acre foot. It's expensive water. The issue we have is there are no other sources. CalAm uses surface water, groundwater. Those are limited, so there's no other waters available. Any new source, as you well know, will be expensive. And I think the point is well taken, is this water will supply some of those underserved communities, particularly in seaside, et cetera. Another element of that is in potentially lifting the CDO and the moratorium, many of the community, many of the cities on the peninsula can open up building low-income housing. So that's sort of that nexus to the underserved. And I apologize, my notes are really awful. Vice Chair Wolf, on climate change, it's something we take very seriously. We're the first in Central Coast to adopt a climate action and adaptation plan. Generally speaking, you know, staff mentioned our plant's about a 30 million gallon per day plant. We get about 17 million gallons per day. So in those flood events, at least in the last 10, 12 years, we've been okay. Our outfall, we can get 80 million gallons per day through there. So we have a little hydraulic capacity to address those sort of issues. Now, on the flip side, you mentioned power also. Power is expensive, so that goes to the cost thing. So I'm trying to make the connection. When Pure Water expansion came online here, it increased our power demands by 136%. So a project we're trying to do right now, and it's in design, is more renewable energy. We've had three cogen engines for over 20 years producing power. We're actually looking at a microgrid so we can island away from PG&E. We're accepting food waste into our digesters for co-digestion, increasing biogas to produce more power, and in the future, renewable natural gas to sell back to PG&E. So we hope to be self-sufficient as well as drive those O&M costs down. You mentioned cybersecurity. Sorry, I'm picking on you. It's just I have them in one area. Okay, so a little over a year and a half ago, we made a change, which is, I think, unique in the public sector. Oftentimes, you have SCADA on one side of the house in a public entity and your IT in another. Well, I made the decision to put it together. So we have an IT director that oversees everything, primarily from a cybersecurity standpoint, not just to our enterprise system, but also for the SCADA. As the picture showed with our control room, which I don't even know how many screens it has in there. It's amazing what these people do. Our operators are phenomenal. But we also have 11 pump stations we own, the 6 injection wells, 26 other pump stations that we maintain and operate for our member entities. And cybersecurity is critical. We have started doing more fiber replacement on the plant site. And if I can go back, when I started at Monterey One over 11 years ago, we had one IT person and a temporary. Our IT director has 9 staff total, each with discrete responsibilities, whether it be SCADA, the enterprise systems, and so on. So we're building that side of the house because we realize, where were we 10 years ago to now, from automation, instrumentation, our reliance on technology, where will we be in another 5 years? Member Hoskins, so you asked a question on the number of tests that are performed. And generally speaking, on our product water, there's online sensors all the time. So the amount of data is tremendous, going back to the cybersecurity side of things. In addition, we do about 300 tests per year on the product water. But on the monitoring wells and what goes into the ground, we do in excess of 6,800 tests per year out there, just making sure that water quality meets the conditions of the permit and all regulations. So it is fairly robust, and then that data does come to the regional board. You also asked about cost recovery, and I'll touch on this. Evan Jacobs with CalAM is here as well. We develop our costs annually in our budget on what we think it's going to be. Based on the number of acre feet we plan to produce as a contractual obligation to the Monterey Peninsula Water Management District, one of our significant partners in CalAM, we calculate that to a cost per acre foot. So I mentioned this year, it's about $4,300. That goes through our board of directors from a vote on our budget. And it also goes to CalAM, who goes to the CPUC for a cost recovery. So we actually bill, through a three-party agreement, the Water Management District in CalAM. We get our cost recovery, and they, I'll let Evan actually talk to it, from the CPUC get approval to charge all of us ratepayers that amount of money. There is a true-up provision, so every year or a couple of years, we look at where the cost came in, and we have the ability to true those up. Member Rhodes, I think you talked a couple things. One was source waters coming into the plant. And just to expand on that, I mean, staff did a great job. Yeah, there's only so much wastewater. And during the summer times, well, during the growing season, pretty much all of it goes out for agricultural irrigation to the Castrel Seawater Intrusion Project. So in developing the first phase of Pure Water Monterey, we look for additional water, stormwater, agricultural drainage water. So those fields that contribute to drainage ditches, it's the tile drains, goes into the drainage ditch. We built 2 pump stations to bring water to our treatment plant to add water to our system. And then also agricultural wash water. You've all gone to the store and got your bagged lettuce or bagged veggies that have been pre-washed. That produces about 3 to 4 million gallons per day in the Salinas Valley. We can take a fraction of that in as well. Some of it comes to us, some of it goes for agricultural irrigation. So there is that ability. I actually forget who said it. I thought it was you on the what's left in the ground and the benefit to the Seaside Basin. So we're building up an operational reserve just in case something happens at the treatment plant or we need to take it down. Knock on wood, that hasn't happened for over 5 years, coming up on six. But right now we have 2,350 acre feet in the ground. So there is a net benefit to the Seaside Basin in having additional highly purified water in the ground.
Paul, is there a seawater barrier or you don't have seawater intrusion there?
There's very minor seawater intrusion into the Seaside Groundwater Basin. It is an adjudicated basin, so they keep pretty darn good track of it. It's entirely a different situation in the Salinas Groundwater Basin, where we're not injecting. That is a critically overdrafted basin that obviously we're all concerned about. And to a certain degree, Castroville Seawater Intrusion Project helps address by providing recycled water versus groundwater for irrigation.
Thank you.
Board Member Rodriguez, you mentioned redundancy of our wells. So we have, as I mentioned, six deep injection wells. Obviously, this is a calculation, so when you get into reality, it could be a little different. But those six wells have enough capacity. There's what we're actually injecting only takes about 70% of the capacity of those wells. So if one goes down or whatever it may be, we do have some excess capacity. However, we are constantly backwashing those wells to make sure they're producing at a given level. So there's a little bit of a balance there. If it's okay, I'd like to jump back to cost for just a second. And I'm not sure if Board Member McGuire is still online, but just wanted to say thank you to the state because overall for the Pure Water Monterey program, both the original one and expansion, the state has helped out with $130 million in state grants and low interest loans. That has been tremendous to try to keep those costs down. Our federal partners have also supplied $30 million in grants as well. So overall, this project was quite affordable, although you're right, the cost of water is up there. I do wanna say, I think I've answered, I tried to touch on all your questions. I'm not sure if I did.
We'll follow up. First of all, thank you. That was excellent, very helpful. On the underserved issue, you said that this was gonna open up opportunities for affordable housing, and you also mentioned Seaside. I guess I just want confirmation. This water that's recycled, and maybe it's for your colleague, it's to serve the entire area, right? It's not just being focused on certain communities, or is it?
No, it's much of the Cal-Am service area. So back, if you can visualize the map that was shown, the Cal-Am service area is from Seaside down through the peninsula to Monterey, Pacific Grove, Pebble Beach, Carmel, Carmel Valley, and Evan can certainly correct me if I'm incorrect there. Depending on how the system operates, our recycled water does go through much of that system.
So folks who live in Carmel, as well as folks who live in Seaside, they're all going to get the benefit of this water that you're producing.
Yeah.
Okay. And then on development, it's going to open up development not just for affordable housing, but across the territory, or is this actually going, or is this actually targeted to try to make sure that we can get more affordable housing?
So it is throughout the entire area. As we mentioned, having a cease and desist order and a moratorium on setting of new meters, there's been limited growth unless you had water credits or something like that. And that is generally administered with the Monterey Peninsula Water Management District and Cal-Am. The reason I brought up low-income housing is as I talk to the various cities in our community, there's a need for setting new meters. Part of that, not entirely, is low-income housing. There has been certainly efforts to make sure that happens within the community.
Thank you.
So this new water truly reflects how collaboration can drive progress and bring water resilience to our coastal communities. You mentioned the Soquel Creek project. I'm a big fan of the recycled water thing as well, being on the board of water reuse. And actually, I'm wearing my SoCal Creek socks right now, if those of you that went there. So I think collaboration is critical. I think we see it on this particular project with the Monterey Peninsula Water Management District, Marina Coast Water District, CalAM, and a number of others. I certainly want to say thank you to all the staff that has helped out and actually done, not just helped out, done all the work on pushing this through, both from the state level and the regional level. And at this point, our construction is complete and we're waiting to flip the switch. I know all the operators out there will hate when I say flip the switch because it's far more complex than that, but we are ready to move forward and start injecting additional water. And if appropriate, I can answer any further questions you may have.
Any other questions? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Shido. Appreciate you being here. Our next speaker is Nina Beatty.
Good morning, Nina Beatty, Monterey resident. This agreement's focus is on treated industrial wastewater monitoring, but the wastewater and the treated sewage already injected is being stored in the ground of a Superfund site, the Fort Ord National Priorities List Superfund site. That's where the Seaside Basin is, and it lies under the most contaminated part of it, Site 39, which was never tested for the hundreds of toxic munitions and pesticide chemicals that permeate the ground and infiltrate into the basin. That's a critical component of this project. Fort Ord Community Advisory Group has sent lists of these substances to local officials for years. As far as I can discover, these substances are not being monitored, and only 10 chemical substances were ever tested for initially at Site 39 at only one sampling site on its perimeter. California American Water Company indicates it's only testing for general state and federal guidelines for water anywhere, not the unique situation of a Superfund site with military contamination. With the increase of Seaside Basin water and the use of treated sewage water to the taps, a nauseating chemical smell is now present in my laundry after I wash and dry it, and I have to air it out for days before using it. Water is now forming crystalline deposits on metal faucets, and molds are growing very quickly in the pipes. This is new. Now Monterey County will be the first in the nation to use industrial wastewater. Synergistic interactions of ag pesticides and fertilizers can happen with cleaning and personal care products, antibiotics, heavy metals, pharmaceuticals, PFAS, and other toxins. Biological cells and organisms are acutely sensitive to tiny doses. Antibiotic resistance and immune system impacts are two effects. Dilution doesn't solve this. Residents are the test subjects for long-term and cumulative exposure in a county already high in cancer and other illnesses. All of this in the push and rush to develop market rate housing on the Superfund land and local cities without warnings or informed consent about the contamination. Officials have repeatedly violated the public trust, claimed safety, and ignored health impacts. The Moss Landing Battery Facility fire is a recent example. Absent a detailed and open examination of Superfund contaminants, interactions, and biology, this water cannot be regarded as safe for potable use or safe to drink, bathe in, inhale the steam from, for children or babies to bathe in, for making baby formula or coffee, or to water vegetable gardens, plants, or trees. Please protect the public and do not adopt this order. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment. Our next speaker is Evan Jacobs. Evan, you're up.
Hi, good morning. I'm Evan Jacobs, Director of External Affairs for California American Water. Wanted to thank the staff for the very informative presentation and the board for the really good questions. I have some quick prepared remarks, and then we'll try to respond to some of the things we've heard from the dais. As was mentioned, we provide drinking water to about 100,000 people, both on the Monterey Peninsula and the Carmel Valley. Historically, over 70% of those water supplies have come from the Carmel River. In 1995, the Water Board found that all those wells in the Carmel Valley were under the influence of surface water and we needed to reduce pumping. We've embraced a three-pronged approach to this water supply solution that includes Pure Water Monterey and the expansion, winter storm flows from the Carmel River being captured and stored in the Seaside Basin, as well as desalination. And the Pure Water Monterey and its expansion are a critical component of this approach. We definitely support this and support this permit. We're going to be the largest customer, continue to be the largest customer of the Pure Water Monterey project. We're contracted for over 30 years to take as much as $500 million of water from the project. And I think that maybe gets us to where we want to talk about some of the affordability issues. As was mentioned, we are regulated by the Public Utilities Commission. So we purchase the water through the Water Management District and then charge it in rates to our customers. We have a number of affordability programs that have been approved by the Public Utilities Commission, and they have to approve all of our rates. Some of the things we do, we currently offer a 35% discount on bills to residential customers. We have tiered rates that encourage conservation and provide for essential water use at a lower rate. We have a crisis assistance program to help people who have a sudden change in financial circumstances pay off their bills so that they can remain in water. And we're looking at expanding both the ongoing program from 35% to 50% of the bill, as well as to institute what's called a multifamily program, where customers behind a master meter who don't pay a water bill directly are still able to receive a benefit of an affordability program. Because we know that within every community we serve, be it Seaside or Pebble Beach, there are people who struggle to afford their utility bills. We want to make sure they stay in water. Some of the questions that came up about our extraction, we currently have 7 active extraction wells in the Seaside Basin. As was mentioned, we are constructing 2 more wells. On our end, after the water is pumped back out, it is treated for both biological and, where appropriate, chemical contamination. We're constantly testing and making sure that our water meets all state and federal drinking water standards. That's very important to us. Looking a little more on the extraction, production is definitely continuing to be something that we're going to be focusing on in the Seaside Basin, really protecting public health on that. And I think I have covered most of the points that came up. We certainly are concerned about cybersecurity as well. My company participates in the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, I believe, CISA. We have representatives on that that really help us monitor and make sure our systems are compliant and protected. So I guess in summary, every drop of water is critical on Monterey Peninsula and in Monterey County. We need all the supplies we can get to ensure safe, reliable water supply for our customers. And urge you to approve this as written, and thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for your comment. Our next commenter is Remley Scherzinger.
Good evening, or good afternoon. Good morning, Madam Chair. Rem Scherzinger, Marina Coast Water District. I was here to support both Monterey One Water and CalAM Marina Coast as a partner in the project. Clearly, we support the board and urge ratification of the permit. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That concludes our public commenters. Yes, Mr. Rodriguez.
If there's no further discussion or comments, I would like to make a motion that we approve the permit or the proposed order. R is in Robert 3-2025-008 as submitted by staff.
Thank you. Motion and a second. Okay, go ahead.
I have a question. I don't know if staff can offer for one of you, but we did hear from one public commenter.
I can't hear very well.
Oh, sorry. I just was just going to ask if anyone can just give us some response about the Superfund site comment. I imagine that's all been looked into. It would be very helpful since we did hear that a little while ago. Thanks.
Yes, so we work closely with our colleagues in the site cleanup program. We did convene with them in regards to this site. To our understanding, there are no known plumes in the subbasin in which these extractions are occurring. There's separation in map distance and in the substrate.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Mr. Lodge.
Yes, just need to clarify that the motion will need to include the changes that are reflected in the supplemental sheet.
Could you speak up? I can hear you, but I would like to make sure everyone else can hear you. I think the note was that the motion needed to include the comments in the supplemental sheet. Is that accurate?
Correct.
So, Mr. Rodriguez,
Would you like to amend your motion to include comments from the supplemental sheet?
Sorry about that.
It's okay. Would you like to amend your motion to include comments included on the supplemental sheet?
Yes, I will.
Okay. Do you want to start the motion over just for giggles?
I would like to amend my motion to include the comments per our executive officer's suggestion.
So we have a motion and a second. We have a motion. Do we have a second?
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yes.
You're great. For the
record, he needs to make a motion to approve order R3. Wow, it's great this morning. R3-2025-0008 with the amendments proposed in the supplemental sheet.
Thank you, Chair. Yes.
Do we have any takers on that?
I will second the motion.
Thank you, Mr. Rock. May we have a roll call vote?
Chair Gray?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wolf?
Aye.
Member Rodriguez?
Aye.
Member Hoskins? Member Rock?
Aye.
Member Harlan?
Aye.
We got there. Thank you very much. Very much appreciate that. Appreciate you all being here today. It's 10:54. We're going to take a 15-minute break. Thank you very much. Okay, it's 11:16. I'd like to call our meeting back to order. The next item on our agenda is item number 9, wastewater needs assessment. Mr. Lodge.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Item 9 is an informational presentation on the State Water Board's ongoing wastewater needs assessment, a 4-year statewide project launched in 2023 to identify sanitation needs and develop strategies to achieve the human right to water goals. Annalisa Kihara and Erica Calve from our State Water Board will summarize the findings from phase one of the assessment, and they are on Zoom this morning.
Hi, good morning, Chair Gray, Vice Chair Wolf, members of the board, and so nice to see you again, Member Rock. I'm Annalisa Kihara. I'm the Assistant Deputy Director in the Division of Water Quality at the State Water Board, and joining me today is Erica Calve. She is the Supervising Engineering Geologist, also in the Division of Water Quality, and her team is leading this effort. And so we both wish that we could be there in person, but do appreciate the opportunity to join you virtually to provide an update on our statewide wastewater needs assessment effort. And then also a thank you to Mr. Lodge for the invitation. Next slide, please. So for this update, I'll cover some background on how this project came about, provide a high-level summary of the project goal and phases, and then share some information about an advisory group we created to inform our efforts. I'll then pass the baton to Erica, who will provide more details on the phase one activities, accomplishments, and any identified challenges we've encountered along the way. And then we'll close it out with next steps. Next slide, please. So we'd like to kick off this update with our guiding star for this effort. The 2012 Human Right to Water Act in California states that every human being has a right to safe, clean, affordable, and accessible water adequate for human consumption, cooking, and sanitary purposes. So this bill was the first of its kind in the nation and was born out of relentless community advocacy from environmental justice communities across the state. And really what it did was challenge us as the state of California to affirm its recognition of this problem and the right to expect more. Next slide, please. So, the Human Right to Water Act was that catalyst to other initiatives at the water boards that we believe are worth noting today. The first in 2016, which is our Human Right to Water Resolution at the State Water Board. And this is where we state that this is a top priority as well as a core value. And then in 2018, the legislature signed Senate Bill, or the governor signed Senate Bill 1215, which is our wastewater consolidation well as a catalyst, and it led to a lot of our wastewater consolidation efforts across the state in terms of identifying and supporting septic to sewer opportunities. In 2019 was when the water boards kicked off our drinking water needs assessment. 2021, we have our racial equity resolution at the state board, where we make the commitment to racial equity, as well as protecting public health in communities with historical environmental inequities. And these were all stepping stones leading to 2022, which was when we kicked off our wastewater needs assessment through a resolution. Next slide, please. So safe and affordable funding for equity and resilience, also known as SAFER. This was part of that larger drinking water needs assessment. That was set in motion by Senate Bill 200, which was adopted after the Human Right to Water Act. And what it did was it created dedicated funding source as well as resources at the water boards for the development of the drinking water risk criteria. For our wastewater needs assessment effort, there's a bit of a difference, well, a large difference. There's no legislative mechanism for funding from the legislature. So this is a state board led and funded effort. We were able to allocate about $4 million to conduct a statewide wastewater needs assessment. And so we have the same lead contractor, which happens to be UCLA Luskin Center for Innovation. They were the leads for the drinking water needs assessment. And the purpose of having them lead our effort was to learn from implementation of the drinking water needs assessment process. Next slide. So I just want to take a moment to recognize the team leaders and regional board executive sponsors for this effort. While Erica and I are here to provide a high-level update, we will do our best to make this team proud. And so I just really want to recognize Greg Pierce. He is a professor at UCLA and the wastewater needs assessment principal investigator. So he's overseeing this effort as part of our contractor. And Danya Jimerson, she is a senior WRCE specialist in the Division of Water Quality at State Board. And Danya came to us bringing her experience implementing septic to sewer solutions in the Central Valley Regional Board. And then Danya would have joined us today for this presentation, but is on a well-deserved vacation and sends her regards. Our other two that I want to make sure to acknowledge are the input from the executives that we have as part of our project. Christina Shoup, she's the Assistant Executive Officer in the Central Valley Regional Board, and Ben Letton, he is the Executive Officer at the Lahontan Regional Board. Next slide, please. So the wastewater needs assessment's overarching goal is to support the water board's vision of clean, safe, and affordable water for human uses and environmental resource protection across California by, and simply put, what we want to do is determine and calculate the number of inadequate and at-risk systems using a transparent, systematic, and replicable approach. And so part of this is really using what data we do have available to inform that assessment. And so what data we do have available are our collection system data, as well as our treatment system data that we collect as part of our water board's databases. Erica will also provide some additional details in an upcoming slide. And so for this overarching goal, the vision is really that this assessment will in turn help communicate the financial needs broadly, and also in the interim, prioritize the smaller pots of funding we may have available to support wastewater solutions. Next slide, please. So I just want to take some time to recognize as well our commitment to apply a racial equity lens to many aspects of this project, from the risk methodology to contractors doing field campaign efforts where they're collaborating with communities. It's also a guiding factor to establishment of the risk and inadequacy assessment, and also with our scientific approach to ensure data transparency and accountability, because all of that information and that data drives our decision making. Next slide, please. Okay, this is a high-level roadmap of the two main phases of the wastewater needs assessment project, where phase one was implemented from 2023 to 2025, laying the foundation for a statewide wastewater analysis through four key subphases, and those are identified as phases 1B through 1E under the phase 1 column. Through these phases, the contractor team developed data methods, launched a survey, identified data gaps, established key definitions needed, and began looking into solution models as well. And so, as I mentioned before, Erica will share some additional details on the subphases 1B through 1E in the coming slides. But just where we are right now, we are in a transitional period where we're closing out our phase one efforts with a summary report that will be released within the next month. And then we're shifting into our phase two efforts. Next slide. So for our advisory group, our lead contractor, UCLA, recommended the formation of an advisory group to obtain diverse engagement outside of the wastewater needs assessment team, as well as the water boards. This was also a successful component of the drinking water needs assessment. And so our advisory group composition consists of 30 diverse representatives from across California, bringing in various perspectives on wastewater treatment, water sustainability, policy, environmental advocacy, community representation, and more. And we're really appreciative to this group for all the great feedback that they've been providing to us throughout our efforts. Next slide. So since July of 2024, UCLA has facilitated 5 advisory group meetings and hosted monthly office hours to answer any interim advisory group member questions. Our next meeting is coming up on Friday, October 24th. All of the meetings are publicly noticed on our webpage and can be accessed by anyone interested in listening in. And so with that tee up, I'll turn it over to Erica, who will walk us through updates on our phase one efforts and then close us out with next steps.
Thank you, Annalisa, and thank you to the Region 3 members and staff for inviting us here. I am going to start us off by orienting you to the project subphases for phase one. As we walk through these slides, there's going to be this diagram off on the, it'll switch sides, but the diagram will be on most of the slides to kind of remind you where which phase subphase we're talking about. And phase 1A, which we don't have a slide on, but kind of was the development of the work plan that laid out the process and procedure for evaluating the baseline conditions of wastewater infrastructure services in California, including the process for collecting, compiling, and assessing data to inform the second phase of research. In phase 1B, the team compiled baseline studies, which set a baseline of understanding for the rest of the wastewater needs assessment project. This included a statewide survey of community needs through a survey that ultimately included over 110 unique responses, that those responses were then able to be brought into a spatial analysis so that the information could be analyzed spatially. And then the team added an extra step of a field campaign to ground truth the information collected and help capture photos and conversations that really helped to illustrate and humanize the data that had been collected during the survey. Another aspect of phase 1B was a literature review of previously published studies and data sources that were potentially relevant to the wastewater needs assessment. One of the key findings after conducting the literature review aspect of this phase was that there is limited foundational data and methods for conducting a wastewater needs assessment, which really makes sense since this is a first of its kind project to do an analysis like this. Phase 1C included additional data gathering to help characterize the universe of wastewater data specific to California. This was an exhaustive survey of publicly available data, mostly obtained through the use of the Water Board's California Integrated Water Quality Systems, or CWICS, database. But it expanded beyond that and used other sources to obtain an extensive list, an exhaustive list of major facility and system types that the Wastewater Needs Assessment Project team will include in the analysis during phase two. And that phase, as Annalisa mentioned, is just now getting started. So the process, this aspect of the project ultimately identified over 2,650 specific facility and systems that are grouped into three major categories based on how they are regulated through the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination, or NPDES system, the waste discharge requirements, or the Sanitary Sewer System General Order, which we also refer to as the SSSGO. It also highlighted several data gaps, some of which the Wastewater Needs Assessment Project team will address as part of the phase two scope of work, but also others that will need to be addressed by the State Water Board and our partners through improved data collection efforts. As noted in italics, the project scope does include on-site systems and unsewered population data as well, but it's handled very differently because of the way that the type of data that we have for on-site systems as compared to the NPDES, WDR, and SSGO. So this figure illustrates the data collection efforts of Phase 1C in a little more detail. Data collection efforts began in November 2023 with a data request to the Division of Water Quality. And by December of 2023, the team had a query of available CWCS reports to obtain a list of wastewater treatment facilities and collection systems. The data was categorized based on the categories of municipal wastewater regulatory programs, NPDES permitted facilities, as mentioned before, WDR, and the SSSGO. The team collaborated directly with many regional water boards to review the data that had been compiled from our statewide database. And a final list of facilities was sent to the executive sponsors and all regional water boards, including the methodology used to document the facilities that will be included in the next phase of the project. The Wastewater Needs Assessment Project team is extremely appreciative of the support the regional water boards have provided. They received meaningful feedback, and it has already resulted in identification of recommendations to improve data management moving forward. So now we're going to dive into some of the very novel aspects of this project that required the development of definitions to support the work of phase two. In phase 1D, the team provided a framework for assessing inadequacy and risk. As noted previously, there are three main categories of regulatory data available to support this effort. And so the inadequacy and risk assessment is grouped into those categories accordingly. And that includes information reported to the water boards via the requirements issued in the NPDES, WDRs, and SSSGO. Examples of the framework for defining inadequacy and risk include the number of sanitary sewer overflows, incomplete monitoring and reporting, and effluent limit violations, and several other. Some potentially useful indicators to characterize inadequacy and risk are excluded due to a lack of available data. UCLA led this and included consultation with the entire project team, as well as designated working groups of water board staff focused on relevant regulation development and compliance aspects to help get to the definitions that will be used as part of phase two. Along the lines of limited data and information to support this process, due to current limitations of our existing data collection efforts, it is clear that there will be cases where we have insufficient data to categorize a system or facility, but otherwise the team will do their best to use all the available information to identify inadequate and at-risk facilities. And to close out the phase one data gathering efforts, the team also developed a framework for identifying wastewater needs assessment solutions and cost estimates. This solutions framework was developed based on the results of the prior phases, as well as supplemental data and resources such as the Division of Financial Assistance engineering reports and experience, and cost estimating tools and information available in the literature. And all of that fed into the process that has now been developed to ultimately provide potential solutions for and to motivate further attention to support California's commitment to improve sanitation access to all Californians. These solutions include, but are not limited to, infrastructure repairs and replacement, operational and managerial oversight enhancements, and interconnection between systems coupled with high-level estimates of the cost of these solutions, which can inform state and local community funding needs and estimates and potential eligibility for funding programs. And as Annalisa mentioned earlier, the team is now transitioning into phase two implementation. The work has begun similarly with the development of a phase two work plan that will be a major focus of the advisory group meeting scheduled for October 24th. And then the project team will implement the approach that they define in the work plan to categorize the systems identified in phase one into the categories of inadequacy and risk that were developed in phase one. The project team will recommend technical solutions and estimate the cost and potential funding sources to help address those system and facility inadequacies or at risk. And the project team will also help the water boards with a roadmap for how the state can take the tools, procedures, and processes that are developed as part of this project and ensure that we can internalize those and continue updating the assessment beyond July of 2027 when the contract will come to completion. And so with that, we want to say thank you for providing this opportunity to share the information about the wastewater needs assessment and for the continued support and engagement of Region 3 for this very important project. As mentioned earlier, our lead senior specialist would be here if she could. So we wanted to share her contact information if there are any detailed questions or follow-up that anyone's interested in. But we're also happy to take questions from you now and do the best that we can to answer them. We also have a very active wastewater needs assessment project website that is regularly updated with new information, and those links are provided here. And so with that, I think we're happy to open it up to any questions that you may have.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate you providing the presentation today. I know, Erica, you're really passionate about this work too, so really appreciate you engaging on this. So I'll turn it over to my colleagues for questions and comments. Yes, Dr. Wolf.
So thank you for your presentation. And the question I have, you know, regard to at-risk wastewater treatment systems, when we're looking at on-site water treatment systems, and then in some areas where you have a LAMP program, which is basically delegation of authority to county to regulate on-site water treatment systems. There is a nexus between the at-risk water treatment system and groundwater protection. Hence, why in some areas where you do have a high density of on-site water treatment systems, you know, we certainly have found where you do have impact on groundwater contamination. So I was not too clear with your presentation and, you know, the detailed evaluation and analysis that you do and data gap, how you're leveraging the information you're gathering pertaining to water treatment systems and the potential impact on groundwater contamination. And you know, there's obviously a lot of data available about groundwater quality. So could you comment on this? And maybe I missed the nexus here, but you know, I'd like a little bit of clarification on your work.
Yeah, I'd be happy to get, or Annalisa, do you want to kick us off and then I can supplement?
Yeah, I can share a little bit about kind of the high level kind of viewpoint that we have, especially with this effort. You are correct, Vice Chair Wolf, that there's a huge component when it comes to on-site systems, especially where LAMPs are in place and its effect on groundwater. And we think that part of this effort would be hand in hand with our kind of our implementation of our on-site wastewater treatment system policy that the state board has and how it can work together, because some of the solutions we think could be identified might be something like regionalization, where we're taking those on-site systems and we're getting them connected to a system. For this effort, a big piece of it is just recognizing that where a solution identified could be that connection, we want to make sure that the systems that are identified are in a place where they can take it on. We want to set them up for success for these solutions. And so that's one reason why a big piece of this phase one project is identifying systems that could potentially be asked to make these connections, whether or not they are able to, they're at risk, or they are at risk of not being able to. And so hopefully that helps with that piece, but we are recognizing that
our OTS policy implementation is a big part and kind of a big part of the larger effort. And at the State Board and the Division of Water Quality, both these programs and efforts all fall under Erica's section.
Yeah, thanks, Annalisa. And I'll just add that one of the, we can probably come back and provide more information about it, but it is a little complicated, but the team is leveraging a machine learning approach to try to help understand and fill in data gaps associated with the on-site systems. And then they'll be able to use this modeled output that will kind of help identify these areas that might be associated with elevated levels of nitrates in groundwater. And so there is an effort to make that connection, but it, because of the lack of data that's collected at this time with regard to on-site systems, it is, that's probably one of the bigger challenges with kind of addressing that particular issue that you mentioned, but the team has it on their radar and they're working on it. I hope that helped, but feel free to ask for clarification.
Yeah, can you expand on the machine learning?
Well, I think that gets really technical really fast, and I don't feel that I'm qualified to speak too much about it, except for to say that the University of Massachusetts Amherst is leading that effort, and they have built a model that's been used in other states. And so they will be kind of using this model that had been built, but now they're kind of refining it for California. And they have some training data that they're able to use through some outreach and data collection efforts, collaborating with some counties' LAMP coordinators. And that should feed into this predictive model. But I think if it's of interest, we could certainly follow up in more detail with when Danya's in the office next week.
So when you mentioned the predictive models and machine learning, are we using the term AI here?
The term what?
AI.
Yes, those are interchangeable terms, machine learning, exactly. And artificial intelligence.
I know. Some people feel that the term AI is overused and abused, so then you use other terms that can be viewed as elegant, like machine learning. But I still think, in your case, ultimately, boots on the ground, which relates to HI, human intelligence, is still going to be a pretty important requirement, because when you're looking at data gap, you know, certainly we're a big state, but you know, there's a lot of unknown older systems that, you know, there are not very good county records. Of course, all new systems, you know, do have to comply with the latest on-site water treatment systems. But you know, we do have a lot of communities where it's still sort of a mystery where everything is located.
Yeah. Agreed. I think that's a great comment, and certainly something that we can bring back to the team, make sure that, you know, they're receiving that feedback.
Yeah, I just want to, I was going to ask about the machine learning too. I just spent a couple of days on electricity issues where I heard that utilities all across the country are starting to use, looking at AI to look back at data they've had for, you know, decades, in trying to understand and improve their systems and get efficiencies and all those kind of things. So when I was watching the first part of your presentation and thought about all the data that you were collecting, it seemed as though there could be some potential, and there might even be potential for some of the things that our, you know, our group uses, you know, our Central Coast staff has to do in terms of all the data that we're managing. So I think it would be really interesting as you gather that, you know, technology. It's good to hear we've got other universities working on it to, you know, maybe make sure that gets shared with us here, because, you know, perhaps there's a way that, but I agree with the vice chair, you know, sometimes it's not sufficient. You certainly need human interaction, but there is so much data that gets collected, and certainly from my experience with electric utilities, that often isn't even used, you know. So if we have a way now to get that data and put it to use, and then get to focus our energy, our staff energy, all of our energy on the outcomes, and like how we get to the next part of your project here, which is, you know, what do we do to improve the situation? I think that's.
Thanks. Just a comment. We talked at our Water Quality Coordinating Committee last year about use of AI at State Board, and also I think had a conversation with our staff about it. So we've had obviously several conversations. It's a tool, just like anything else, right? So really needs to be married with that human component and ground truthing. Questions or comments on the presentation? Yes.
Well, just in terms of the AI question, we are starting to see it more in our software platforms at the state. They're slowly rolling out various software tools with Microsoft and Adobe. And so we have some staff that are starting to dabble in that. But it's a slow process. We want to be very diligent about how we use those tools. And it is a tool. And they do need to be checked and verified with our staff and the data is accurate and all that. But there is a potential for it to be very useful. But we're being very deliberate in how it's rolled out.
I really appreciate this presentation. This is, again, like years in the making. You know, I think we were all really excited when we saw, you know, the water treatment facility assessment or the, you know, the water supply assessment facility. And it's been, I think we've been talking about it leading up to this for just years to get to this point. And I really appreciate the focus that you have, the lens with accessibility to underrepresented communities, to racial justice. I mean, I do think that oftentimes people don't think about wastewater access as a social justice and a racial equity issue, and it certainly is. And so I really appreciate that focus in the mission and the work that you've uplifted, because we do see a lot of challenges statewide with people not having access to adequate wastewater treatment facilities, whether those are septic systems or the ability to consolidate. So the high level look that you're taking with ensuring that systems do have the capacity and can be identified for those consolidations, I think is really fantastic. Those are my comments. And I don't know if anybody else has any other comments, but really appreciate you taking time to be here today and appreciate your dedication, both of you, to this work and bringing it to us.
Well, thank you, Chair Gray. We really appreciate the support, the input, and the interest as we move forward with this effort, and we'd be happy to, especially as we ease into phase two and we close out this project, work with Mr. Lodge on any future updates for you all.
Yeah, I actually do have a question in marrying it with technical assistance. How are you proceeding with that? Similar to, you know, clean water and access to water supply?
Yeah, I think, I don't know if Erica, you wanted to start. I'm happy to.
Either way.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I know that that's one of the aspects of our coordination efforts with the Division of Financial Assistance is recognizing, you know, kind of the opportunities for technical assistance. And so that's going to be part of the considerations as they dive into the solutions and cost assessment. But I don't know if there's, you know, so please add.
No, please. I just wanted to add like more big picture, I think. While yes, technical assistance is a big component, there's not a lot of funding that we have available, especially for wastewater solutions. And that's why we recognize that this project will help us inform how to prioritize those small pots of funding. But like long-term vision is we're really hoping that it tells a very compelling story that could hopefully unlock future funding for solutions in the future as well with the legislature or with the federal government, whatever it may be.
Thanks. Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And this sort of goes to the conversation we had this morning on the Monterey One Water Project. Is water is water is water, right? We can't look at it as wastewater. It's a resource. And every drop of water that we have needs to be brought back into the system and used appropriately. So, you know, to the discussion that we had a little bit off topic on affordability, you know, all of this is, you know, extremely important as we grapple with some of the, not only the affordability issues, but the overall
dwindling water supply issue, you know, the droughts that we have and the cycles of climate change that we're seeing. And again, this is out of our territory, but are you, is anybody dialoguing on, I guess, the policy issues related to, again, not in our purview, but the land use issues associated with any sort of consolidations?
I'm not sure if I understand the question completely.
Yeah, so I mean, there's obviously when you're working on consolidations, there's things outside of our purview, just with any project, right? On permits and requirements, and you know, housing, and are we having any of those global conversations?
I think as we go into phase two, especially because we've kicked off kind of the discussions and the brainstorming of solutions models, it's a great question and a great comment that we're going to bring back to the wastewater needs assessment team, because if it hasn't already been identified as part of the discussions we've had with our advisory group members, who represents like very, very broad aspects and perspectives, also, you know, with consolidation as well and regionalization, I imagine that as we start kind of looking at what like a model of an at-risk system and what the solutions will look like and how can those solutions be achieved, this may and will likely come up as an issue that could be identified.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Any other questions or comments? Thank you so much for being here today. Really appreciate your time and all your work on this.
Yeah.
Good to see you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, the next item on our agenda is our enforcement report.
Thank you, Chair Gray. I'd like to introduce Tamara Anderson, still in her role as enforcement coordinator for the Central Coast region. She's going to provide our quarterly-ish enforcement report for us today.
Thank you, Mr. Lodge. So good morning, or soon to be good afternoon, Chair and members of the board. I'm Tamara Anderson, a supervising water resource control engineer. And as Mr. Lodge mentioned, I'm currently also filling in as our region's enforcement coordinator. And then also here to help field questions during this item is Angela Schroeder, our assistant executive officer. So item 8 includes our regular quarterly enforcement update. And attachment 1 of the staff report includes enforcement actions taken from the beginning of April through the end of July. I'm going to walk you through the tables in attachment 1. So table 1 includes 2 administrative civil liability orders to resolve mandatory minimum penalties for effluent limit violations from the Carmel Area Wastewater Treatment Facility and the City of Santa Barbara's El Estero Water Resource Center. And then moving on to table 2, which includes 4 issued expedited payment program letters to resolve mandatory minimum penalties for effluent limit violations at the San Simeon Community Services District Wastewater Treatment Facility, the Granite Rock Arthur Wilson Quarry in San Benito County, the City of San Luis Obispo's Water Resource Recovery Facility, and then you also see the City of Santa Barbara's El Estero facility, but that's for the same resolved mandatory minimum penalty included in Table 1.
So I have a couple questions, and thank you, Ms. Anderson. Appreciate you being here today and providing us with this report. Can you characterize where San Simeon Community Services District is in dealing with some of their own issues of relocating off the beach? Are they, do you know where they are in that process?
So they are going through, just with their management, some challenges right now. And I know, so there's it's 2 kind of compounding things happening right now. One is the actual facility and running of the facility and issues related to the operations, and then also the siting and location along the coastline. So that's one issue. And then there's also the actual service district and management. And I know they're going through some just sorting out what the future looks like. And San Luis Obispo County has been filling in and providing some interim support right now as they're navigating what the future of the operations and management of the system looks like. Regarding your question about future siting of the facility, that's something we can report back to you on.
Thank you. Go ahead.
From the Elastero Water Resource Center, so they paid the mandatory minimum, but they also fixed, like in these situations when you have a settlement, something done so it doesn't happen again besides.
Yeah, great question. So when we issue, when there's an effluent limit violation in an MPDS permit, and we go through our process, which all the ones here, we went through our expedited payment program process and just pursued the mandatory minimum penalty as opposed to discretionary enforcement. And part of resolving those is we do not have a condition that the violation that it was for sure resolved. That's not something that we, at least for these, that's not part of that process. However, our staff do regularly check these and work with the dischargers to look at, especially when there's recurring situations, was it a one-off situation or is it something recurring? And are they addressing, you know, fixing the root of the problem? With regards to the Santa Barbara effluent limit violation for settleable solids, that is something that has not been a reoccurring situation yet.
Could you just speak to the San Luis Obispo sort of ongoing violations there?
Yes, I'd be happy to. And we're going to break it apart because there's different sets of parameters. So instead of talking about them globally. So for the nitrate effluent violations, so we, the board a while ago issued a time schedule order. So there's a couple different time schedules orders in place. But related to the nitrate issues at the facility. And so the City of San Luis Obispo went through some significant upgrades at the facility, and they have completed their new biological treatment facility to upgrades to address the recurring nitrate issues that they've been having. So you'll see a few violations, and those actually happened when they were transitioning from the old processes to the new processes, and they had some hiccups with just that transition process and also some of their notification system. So they have got those resolved. So that's related to the nitrate piece. The molybdenum is related to, that's addressed in their more recent TSO that was issued in, I think, June of 2024. And for that, the city is still looking at what is causing those issues. And they are doing what's called, they've developed a draft pollution prevention plan and source identification study. So they're looking out into the sources of what's causing that issue coming into their influent into the facility. So that is something that is they're actively working on, and we're reviewing their draft plans.
Thank you. Thank you.
And then there's also dichloromethane, but I'll just say disinfection byproducts. So you'll see a few violations related to those. And part of the city's upgrades, because that's a disinfection byproduct when you use chlorine, and they switched their disinfection from using chlorine to using UV. So they're now on UV at the facility. However, they still do use chlorine for their recycled water stream. So they haven't removed chlorine from their facility. One of the things that they think may have caused one of these hits is they actually use bleach to clean the buckets where they take the sample. So they've used changed their processes for cleaning their sampling mechanisms. So that's an example of just doing some reconnaissance work and figuring out what's causing some of these hits.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate that detail.
I'm going to shift to table. Feel free to come back with more questions when I switched to table three in the enforcement report. So that includes one issued time schedule order that we issued to the City of Greenfield for their wastewater treatment facility. And the city is enrolled in our region's general waste discharge requirements for domestic wastewater systems with flows greater than 100,000 gallons per day. We also refer to that as the big order. And Greenfield is not currently able to meet some of the order's effluent and receiving water limitations.
So we issued this time schedule order to lay out some interim requirements for them for those limitations, but also to give the city time to implement some of their planned upgrades to be able to meet those limitations in the future. And the city is going through a phased process. They plan to install they already did a feasibility study and are planning to install a membrane bioreactor at the plant. They are, they're a small disadvantaged community, and one of the big challenges for them is getting and securing funding. So they are actively working with the State Water Board Division of Financial Assistance to look for funding options. Likely due to the costs of this project, it probably will exceed the amount that can be covered through a grant. So it will likely be a combination of a grant and loan to fund this work. And then moving on to table four, this includes all the issued notices of violation covering all of our various Central Coast Water Board programs. And I did want to highlight that in the irrigated lands program, we're going through a process, which we've shared with you before, but just to remind you to identify farms that are not enrolled in the ag order and appear to have commercial irrigated agricultural activities. And we have been going through a process of sending orders to require recipients to submit an application for permit coverage or to provide justification for why they are not required to enroll. And during this reporting period from April to July, we issued about 30 notices of violation for entities that received the requirement to submit an application and failed to submit the application or response by the required due date. And then lastly,
sorry, Ms. Anderson, we have a question.
Sorry. Do we have any sense of either percentage or number of farms which are still not enrolled? I know we don't know what we don't know. I get that. But do we have any sense?
So excellent question. I'm actually going to hand this over to Mary Hamilton, and in her section includes the irrigated lands program.
Thank you for the question. Is this working well? Yeah. I do have a number for you. I need a moment to pull it up, but I will get that and chime back in just a moment.
Stay tuned.
Any other questions or comments in the meantime? Yes.
I can't hear Ann.
Oh, sorry. It's a state facility. And it looks like it's not just failure to submit a report. It's actually a little more than that. Is there an ongoing effort now to work with them to try to, or work with wherever they fit within the state system to try to come up with a solution? It looks a little different than some of the other items on this list.
Yeah, thank you for the good questions, Board Member Hoskins. So we are actively working with, and we have been for a while, with Atascadero State Hospital because they have had a recurring issue with noncompliance. And they're evaluating, looking at the option of either upgrading their facility or actually doing a connection with Atascadero's wastewater treatment plant. And they've completed about 50% design plans for if they were to do the connection process. So they are moving along with that potential solution.
Appreciate that coordination and work with that. I mean, this is a notice violation, but it's important given it's a state facility that we can move that along.
I can't hear that.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. So sorry. No, I was just saying that I appreciate, you know, the coordination as well as putting the, you know, obviously giving the notice of violation, but given that it's a state facility and a very important health facility, appreciate the work the staff is doing on that. Any other questions and comments? Okay. Yes, Ms. Hamilton, thank you so much for your alacrity.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I just was pulling up in the executive officer's report, you'll find our strategic plan update, which includes program narratives. And in the irrigated land section, just in case you want to refer to this later, we include that summary statistic. So I'm going to still navigating. Apologies. It's actually in the accomplishments part of that report. So that's also an attachment. And?
Well, I have a question in the meantime. So Ms. Anderson, there's always seemingly a preponderance of cannabis projects on this list. Have we seen any change in that number up or down? In terms of compliance with,
I was going to say, yeah. So is it in terms of those that are enrolled or yeah. In terms of compliance? I'm also going to see, and might need to get back to you, but if Mary's multitasking over there, but if Mary Hamilton is able to answer that question.
Take it away, Mary.
Okay, so in the accomplishments section that's attached to the strategic plan update in the executive officer's report, we show that we have about 85% of total acres that we estimate to be in agriculture production are enrolled, and we are actively working to enroll more each day. So our staff are all dedicated to identifying and contacting ranches that we believe that are not enrolled yet. And to your second question, I was busy reading and wasn't listening carefully. Would you mind repeating?
Yeah, no problem. Sorry to hit you with a double whammy there.
That's what we're here for.
Yeah, so I was just wondering about sort of compliance with the cannabis order and if we've seen, an uptick in compliance, or we don't really have a good sense.
Fair question. I don't know that we have a good sense of trends and uptick of compliance. We have been building our cannabis team, so we now have 3 staff up from 1 just 6 months ago. So we have been participating in lots of unenrolled site inspections. In fact, our staff are going out later this week. Which would be tomorrow. And we are working with growers who are enrolled to ensure compliance. So we certainly have an uptick in our presence and our ability to work with growers who are enrolled legally and are not, but I don't have trend data information yet. We will take note of that and try to report out on that later next year.
I appreciate that. I know that that program has been beleaguered in terms of staff membership. So I appreciate you characterizing that for me.
Thank you for the question.
So, follow-up question to the 15% of non-compliance. How does that track to, you know, previous years? About the same percentage? Or are we inching away bit by bit?
Yeah, it's not quite an apples-to-apples comparison because each year it's different estimate of what we believe might be irrigated agricultural acres, and some of those are not, in fact, irrigated lands. They are pasture and or dry farmed and or other things. So the acreage that we use as the basis for that calculation changes, and the acreage that's actually being farmed changes each year, and we have people enrolling and unenrolling for various reasons.
And so, when you use the acreage, is it what I'll call physical acreage, or is it based on the number of crops? Because, you know, you can have 10 acres and you do 3 crops, that's 30 acres.
It is based on physical acres as opposed to number of acres that are farmed each year. So it would be the 10 acres in that example, not the 30.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead.
Make sure we talk into the microphone. We're getting some feedback.
Number 5, effluent limitations is 168. I'm just wondering how that's for the period of about 4 months, 3 to 4 months. How does that relate? Like, is that typical amount? Are we seeing, and I kind of feel like you've done trend lines for us before, so maybe you've already done that. So I'm just wondering, it's not insignificant, 168. So just wondering where you see that fall on your experience.
So I would have to, I want to graph this now. So I want to come back with some some graphs and tables for you, but so I can't share exact numbers. I will share, we have a few facilities that do have an accumulation of unresolved mandatory minimum penalties, which might be making that number not fully representative of what we typically see. And that's just due to some active enforcement cases that we are currently dealing with.
Okay, so you're saying maybe in the future you give us some kind of trend line. I guess the question is, you know, we do the enforcement cases and then the hope is they'll provide a deterrent or something, and certainly things will get fixed and the number will eventually start to go down. But just sort of wondering, you know, when, and also, as you said earlier, sometimes you'll do an enforcement and part of that doesn't require them necessarily to, I guess they do their mandatory minimum, necessarily fix it. So just trying to understand for, you know, where we think that's going. And because you're obviously doing a lot of great work in doing the enforcement, so just trying to understand, but we can maybe come back to that in a future meeting.
Yeah, that's it. It's something we're very attentive to when we look at, unfortunately, the folks that we tend to see having these recurring violations. That does inform our prioritization strategy for whether that's more focused compliance work, oversight, or combined with enforcement. So that is something that we use as part of our prioritization strategy. But like I said, that number is potentially not representative typically of what we'll see, just because we do have a few facilities right now with a batch of unresolved MMPs.
Any other questions, comments? Okay. Oh, yes. Board Member Rock.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just, as I recall, the MMPs, mandatory minimum penalties, are sort of auto-generated. They aren't dependent on staff's oversight, ongoing oversight of a facility or facilities. Is that correct?
So facilities have to report their effluent limit data into the CWCS database. And then facilities are actually required to self-report when they have violations. We then, as staff, go and review that data and also make sure that they self-report correctly. And sometimes, not always, sometimes they miss violations. So we also identify violations as well. And then we go through a process to identify which of those violations, because not every effluent limit violation triggers a mandatory minimum penalty. So we have to go through a process, a calculated process, to figure out which ones trigger the need to pursue mandatory minimum penalties. Late reporting also is something that can trigger mandatory minimum penalties for MPDS-regulated facilities. And then we are obligated to pursue the mandatory penalty, or we have the option to just to pursue what's called discretionary enforcement and pursue higher than the mandatory minimum penalty. The mandatory minimum penalty is $3,000 per violation. Let me know if I'm answering your question, but we do not verify whether someone has addressed the violation and prevented it from reoccurring before we pursue, or we're not obligated to do that, the mandatory minimum penalty. And that's part of it, is we're just obligated as an agency to pursue those. However, we do track closely those facilities that maybe have the ongoing recurring violations. And that's something that we then are more, you know, follow up and what's causing these issues. And that will trigger us to do more focused.
Yeah, thank you. I was wondering whether there's a correlation in terms of the number of violations that we're seeing, somewhat following up somewhat on Member Hoskins' comment, and staff resources to address those, and whether with, you know, transition in the workforce and such, you see that number going up and down more as a result of staffing and resources than the facility's actual operations. So thank you for your answer.
And I guess I'll just add, there's a few facilities could kind of skew this number. I'll just share that. A few facilities may have a lot of violations, and that can kind of maybe make it so it's a little hard to do that comparison.
Okay, any other questions or comments? Okay, It's 12:14. At this time, we're going to break for lunch. We have an item we'd like to read into the record. Ms. Rowley?
Just announcements for closed session. Item 12, numbers 3, 4, 5, and 8, they're under. We'll be meeting in closed session pursuant to Government Code, Section 11126, Subdivision E, like elephant.
Thank you, and we will not return before 1:30. So we will reconvene probably at 1:45, 1345. So, but again, not before 1:30. Thank you. Hey, it's 1351. We are going to reconvene our meeting here on October 9th. The next item on our agenda is item number 10, our executive officer's report. And before that, do we have any report out from closed session at all, or are we good? Great. So item number 10, please.
Thank you, Chair Gray. We've got a few items in the executive officer's report for this meeting, so I'll go through those briefly and see if there's any questions from the board. We do have a supplemental sheet for the executive officer's report that includes a section about our Sable offshore core, and the complaint that was filed by the Attorney General's office, and I'll get to that after I go through our strategic plan and our Hacienda items in the report. So there is a section in the EO report where we're reporting out on our strategic plan. You may recall that a year ago at this time at the October board meeting, we presented the strategic plan that included all of our programs and program priorities. And we had a pretty comprehensive presentation from our section managers that included an overview of every program and the priorities for each of those programs. Now, this year we're providing a higher level overview, and we'll do another detailed review at next year's October meeting is the plan. We're planning to do those every other year. So this year we did go through the plan with every program. We evaluated the priorities from the previous fiscal year, so fiscal year 24-25, in preparation for establishing new priorities or modifying priorities for fiscal year 25-26. So we went through that with each section and every program, and they updated those priorities. And it's the strategic plan is really becoming a tool for us to use to evaluate resources and resource allocation and evaluate how we allocate those resources into which programs and what priorities and projects that we're working on within those programs. As you're aware, we have a lot of projects or issues that pop up throughout the year that are not planned. For example, the Sable pipeline issue that we're dealing with, the Vistra battery plant fire that we've talked about, a lot of projects that we don't anticipate. So the strategic plan helps us to look at those priorities and rank different projects and unfortunately have to push some other work off the plate so that our staff can focus on more timely issues that have come up. So we worked on that with our staff. We're really using it as a tool. And we also included accomplishments in this year's evaluation. It's the first year we've done that. That was at the request or the suggestion of a board member or two in the past that it would be good to put accomplishments within the strategic plan. So we've done that. We had a pretty comprehensive list of accomplishments that we went through with our programs and program managers, and we summarized it down to a fairly condensed list, even though it's still pretty long. We do a lot. Our staff are very, very good at doing work in an efficient manner and get a lot of things done. As Mary pointed out earlier, talking about the accomplishments, there are some of our programs have state metrics, and we report out on those in the accomplishments page or attachment, I should say, and that's attachment one to the strategic plan. But we've accomplished a lot. We'll continue to work with the evolving, projects we have, the evolving workforce we have. We've done a lot of hiring in the past year. We still have some more hiring to do. We have about 8 vacancies right now. We have had to endure some budgetary constraints. As I mentioned, the last year's report, we lost some vacancies. We don't know what the budget will look like for next year. This year, we didn't have really constraints and any, we didn't get any vacancy sweeps, but it remains to be seen what will happen next year with the budget. I also want to point out we're working a lot on our workforce planning. That's an accomplishment that we had this year in terms of we convened a workforce planning committee of our staff. It may have actually started the previous fiscal year. So we have staff that will volunteer to be on the committee. They serve about 6 months. And so they've gone through the feedback we received from the previous year. We had a survey and had some breakout sessions with our staff about what we can do to better support them and provide resources and tools for them to do their best work. So the committee worked to refine that. The first committee, the second committee come out with some more concrete ideas about how to move some of those suggestions forward. So they've since developed a job shadowing database and opportunities. That was one of the suggestions, is more cross-program training opportunities for our staff. And we agree that makes for a better staff, a more skilled staff, a more motivated staff. They have an opportunity to increase their skill set and become increase their career opportunities. And so we have they've set up a job shadowing, basically, I don't want to know if it's a database, but a spreadsheet. The staff will go in there and put in opportunities for field work, to go to a meeting, an outside meeting with different agencies or whatnot, and other staff can look in there and say, okay, I'm interested in this. I work with their supervisor. Say, hey, I'm in the stormwater program, but I want to go tag along at a landfill inspection or whatnot, or a wastewater treatment plant. And they've also developed a subject matter expert database as well. So we're having staff populate a database with their expertise, because a staff person may work in the stormwater program, they may have previously worked in a land disposal program or a wastewater program or site cleanup. And we have a lot of new staff who may not know that. And so sometimes they're thinking, oh, the person next to me is an expert in stormwater, when in reality, they've had 10 years of experience working in land disposal or active oil fields. So we're developing that as well as a resource for our staff, again, under the guise of, not the guise, but under workforce planning and continuing to try to build a more resilient workforce. Yes.
So refresh my memory, how many, what's the number of staff that we have right now, excluding the 8 vacancies?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think we're at about 80 staff or 80 positions.
We used to be around 80 something.
Right. And we've had an increase in program. You know, we've added some oil field positions. We've added the recycled water program. We've added some 401 positions through BCP because of new legislation and augmentation. So we've added positions, but then we've also had vacancies that were swept. So we've stayed fairly static for the past probably 5 to 10 years, I want to say, when all things are said and done.
So, okay, so then my other question, how many interns do we have right now, if any?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer. How many interns do we have? And is that information looking towards, or is that public? Okay. So during last year's budget constraints, we lost the ability to hire most of our student interns. So we had, we have about 10 or we had eight positions. At this point, we're going to retain 2 of those. And that's all the budget we have to retain for the remainder of the fiscal year, or 3 for the remainder of the fiscal year. We did get funding for a C Fellow grant or a C Grant Fellow for 1 year. And then we also received an intern for 1 year from the state that's funded by the State Water Board. So that'll mean we'll have five, but we lost a considerable amount of our intern budget as a permanent cut from last year's budget.
All right, because you know, in past years, interns were also an opportunity at times to be lack working here.
Oh yeah.
We'll get you a full-time job.
Looking around, because I think Christina almost earlier was a student with us. Angela was a student. Tamara Anderson mm-hmm. was a student. Mary Hamilton was a student. So we've got a lot of former
it's
students.
It's really a successful program.
Yes. Yeah, it's a tremendous hit to have to, or to not be able to retain those students. They do a lot of really good work, really important work. And it provides an opportunity for us to teach them as well. It also provides an opportunity for our staff to kind of mentor and work on their management skills when they're not a manager. You know, it's a real loss.
Thanks.
Did you want to carry on that item, or?
I didn't feel like I was carrying on, but I could.
No.
I'm joking. Sorry.
wasn't meant like that. Didn't say you were babbling or anything. I just meant we might have interrupted you.
No.
Okay.
I'm just checking my notes. So I'm sorry. I think that's it for the strategic plan. If there's any other questions.
No, I just had some comments before. Okay. You continued. That's all. I really appreciate the attachment one. There's a lot of work going on, and I know that we know that there's a lot of work going on. We get, you know, amazing informational updates, and we're here at the board moving through permits. And, you know, last year we talked about the mentoring program and had folks speak about how important that was. And, I remember starting the strategic plan process. It was a little uncomfortable, I think, for everybody. And so I'm really happy we're at this point now where, you know, staff has been able to engage and really craft the strategic plan to where they need it to be, certainly. So it's really just gratifying to see. I know that we've had staffing cuts, and that's uncomfortable as well, but our staff is amazing, I feel like, and we persevere and we continue to do really good work for the region and for the state of California. And so we just really want to uplift that. And the support that our staff give to one another, I think, is really wonderful. So I will stop carrying on, and I'll let other people opine.
Also, yeah, say that the strategic plan itself is just a very helpful resource for anyone out there who wants to know what we do. It was helpful to me, you know, as I started to be a member here. But it's really well done because it, you know, is concise, but it still gives really good background about what each of the different programs are and the priorities. So I think that's fantastic, and I appreciate the work that you do on that. Thank you.
Dr. Wolf.
So to use your words, I will carry on with my theme associated with HR. And I think another accomplishment is that, you know, in the last year and a half, particularly, you know, we have quite a few folks who took retirement. And every time that happens, you know, there's a significant amount of knowledge that goes with the departure of people who have been with us for, you know, in some cases, 30 years, even more. So as we bring new people on board, new hire, there's a significant amount of effort that is required from all of you, you know, to get our new generation, so to speak, you know, up to speed, and then also to bring forth to them, you know, the culture of the organization. And that's a term we haven't used for some time, but you know, we do have a culture. Right? I mean, we look at our mission, but there is an inherent culture which is very valuable and important. And maintaining, you know, that culture and nurturing it, that doesn't come by osmosis, it requires work. I wanted to acknowledge also, you know, with the rest of the staff, all your good work. And when we talked about mentoring, it's bringing our new employees on board, and both technically, but also this is what it takes to work here at the Regional Water Quality Control Board. So thank you for.
Yeah, it's part of the workforce planning. The reason we're doing it is the recognition of the need for succession planning and proper training, and to transfer as much of that knowledge as we can. And I do want to acknowledge that a lot of this new staff we have, they're new to the water board, but they bring a tremendous amount of skills and experience from other agencies, the private sector. So we're learning from them as much as they're learning from us. And we see that as an opportunity. But it is a lot of work, and we've relied on a lot of experienced staff in the past, and we've been very fortunate. But through retirements and that attrition, we made a focused effort or a concerted effort to try to make sure that the new staff are getting up to speed as best as they can, and that their ideas are heard, but also understanding what our culture is. And that's, we're talking about being a learning culture, and we're trying to implement that and make sure that we provide opportunities for those new staff to learn, not only just technical side of things, but how we do things at the Central Coast Water Board. So yeah, we appreciate that.
Yeah, so I will say I appreciate that database, because I think that helps that growth mindset, you know, ultimately giving people opportunities, that promotes retention as well, because everybody wants to feel like they're valued, but also like they're learning something, that there's an upward trajectory for them. So I think that's really critical. So I applaud you for doing that. I think it's great work.
And it is something that we have to consider in terms of, again, our program priorities. It does take time, and we have to strike that balance between the technical work and the opportunities to learn and to get better at what we do.
But I think it's an investment well worth it, because all of the issues, I mean, all of us come here with, you know, our mandate to serve the Central Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board, but we have our backgrounds and we look at things from different perspectives. And certainly everybody that works at the water boards does as well. So allowing people to flex different muscles and look at things, you know, multidimensionally and holistically, I think is an added benefit. Mr. Rock.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just going to pile on with that, the same theme that Chair Gray and Board Member Vice Chair Wolf spoke to, which is, A, it's a critically important pivot that you've made to do workforce planning, the generational changes, the technological changes that are occurring are going so fast, I can't keep up. So, really critical and intelligent move to do that. But also what you just spoke to, Ryan, which was, or Mr. Lodge, which is that it's taking you away from the technical work. I mean, you can't do both, or you can do both, but you have to balance it. And I just wanted to say, I looked at this accomplishments report and it's incredibly impressive. I used to work there and I know what even a fraction of this amount of work represents. And it was really an impressive report, 1 year's worth of accomplishments, really impressive. And on top of it, you're going to try to balance that workforce planning and mentorship approach as well. So I say, go for it, be careful. But I'm fully behind the effort and really applaud you for all the good work.
Yeah, I really appreciate the kind words. Yeah, it's the staff, obviously, they do the work, and the amount of accomplishments was very impressive. And that's a condensed kind of summarized list. It's the first time we've done this, so we will try to refine it for next year, potentially. Yeah, they just do an amazing amount of work. They're getting more and more efficient using different tools. And we just, you know, as you know, the workload continues to get bigger, the plate gets fuller. But our staff is really, really good at finding efficiencies to get more things done and continue to engage with the public as well. I mean, that's important that we make sure we engage with the regulated community. So, yeah, it's impressive. OK, Okay, I will carry on. So the next item in the executive officer's report is an update on Hacienda Apartments project that our wastewater consolidation team has been working on for several years. They've been working since about, I think, 2021. Well, let me back up. There, in 2018, the governor signed legislation that provided us the authority to work on wastewater consolidation and ultimately compel mandatory consolidation for failing systems into other collection systems. So when that occurred, we did get some resources for wastewater consolidation work, and we've had staff working on that in this particular project since 2021, working with the county, or trying to work with the county of Monterey and the city of Soledad. So this relates to an apartment complex outside the city of Soledad that has failing septic systems. The state stepped in with some technical assistance to provide, and they developed a engineering feasibility report to look at alternatives, replacing the septic systems at the current location is not an option, not a viable option due to space constraints. Also, the soil type. And so the recommendation, at least the preliminary recommendation, because it's not a finalized report, is that they connect to the city of Soledad's collection system. That connection is relatively close, a few hundred feet away. And so we're working with the city and the county to try to make that consolidation happen. We've been working with them for a while. As part of that statute that was signed, we issued a 6-month letter in July notifying the city and the property owner that they need to negotiate connection or try to negotiate a connection. We've met with the city already, and we have another meeting with them coming up to continue discussions about how to move that forward. If we're not successful in those discussions after that 6 months, before the end of that 6 months, I should say, we will have a public meeting and provide opportunity for the members of the public and members of that apartment complex to comment and provide us their input on the situation. If we're not making progress or haven't made progress after that 6 months, we will consider drafting an order that would require connection, and we'd have to bring that to the board. We hope we don't get to that point, so we're going to continue to work with the various parties to try to get that to happen. The state will pay for that consolidation. There are grants available so that it won't cost the city any capital costs. So we're trying to work with them to make that work. It is complicated because this apartment complex is not within the city limits. It's in a unincorporated area of the county. So there are some complications that we would need to work through, but we're gonna try to continue to do that in the next few months. I wanted to give you that, just an update on that, because we did issue that letter. We are at the forefront of wastewater consolidation right now. There are no other wastewater consolidation projects that are at the point we are, where we're getting close to potentially having to issue an order for mandatory consolidation. It's relatively new, and so we're kind of at the forefront for that. But because we issued that letter, I wanted to give an update to the board so that you had an understanding of where we were with that.
I also think, I appreciate the update. Thank you. I also think this complements the discussion we had on the wastewater, study and the statewide sort of assessment of where we are. And again, this really is an environmental justice and racial equity issue, particularly with this project. So appreciate the work that we're doing on the leading edge with, being the first in the state, and that comes with a lot of complexities, and also understanding that this is a complex site. So appreciate the work that you and staff are doing on that.
So, you said that the apartment complex is in the unincorporated area outside of the city limit. And my understanding, the city limit, you could throw a stone at it. So Do they have a LAFCO, or, you know, most cities have a sphere of influence in terms of, you know, potential growth, annexation, etc. That also provides a pathway of being able to take the next step that is already a part of a long-term plan of expansion.
Yeah, we would need to work, we would need to work through the LAFCO process. I don't know that the city limits is a stone's throw away. The connection is a stone's throw away. There is another, there's another apartment complex next door that is connected to the sewer system. So they've done this before in terms of providing services to a facility that's not within the city limits. So we would work with them through that similar process to get that connection to work. But I'm not sure if it's in, I haven't looked at whether it's in the sphere of influence or what part of the.
Therefore, there's precedent already of a connection outside of a city limit.
Correct.
Thanks.
Any other questions or comments on that item? Hi, Stephanie, go ahead.
Thank you. Are we working closely with the county? Because they should be a partner in this also if the property is in the county and should be contributing financially. And have we made some connections there that can help us?
Yes, we have been meeting with the county and the city and trying to work with them, I believe, since 2021. I've been on meetings myself with the county and the city. So yeah, they're a party to these discussions and will continue to be until we can get this resolved.
Are they accepting some responsibility because since the property's in the county?
I don't know that they would be. Yeah, the responsibility ultimately for the failing septic system is that of the property owner, I would say. The county does have a local agency management plan, a LAMP that they should, are required to enforce for failing septic systems. But in terms of taking responsibility, they're not really a party to that. They don't have to take, I guess, responsibility for that apartment complex.
Yeah. Thank you.
But we will continue to, try to coordinate with them and work with them the best we can to get to a resolution.
Thanks, Stephanie. Any other questions or comments?
Okay. And then the last item, other than the normal tables that are in the EO report, is a supplemental sheet, which is related to the Sable Offshore Corp. They, as is stated in the report, there is a link to a complaint that was filed by the Attorney General's office. There's a link to a press release related to that. And then there's also a link in there referring the public back to the April board meeting where this board referred the case to the Attorney General's office. So just to back up a bit, this is related to a pipeline along the Gaviota Coast primarily. It also goes into San Luis Obispo County and into the Central Valley that failed and ruptured in 2015, causing an oil spill. So the Sable Offshore Corp has been doing maintenance on that line late 2024. And they've been doing maintenance activities that has without obtaining permits from us. So 401 certification permits and stormwater permits. Our staff had gone up, done some investigations, done some inspections, issued some notices of violation. And we got to a point where we thought it was best to refer the case to the Attorney General's office to take enforcement action further. And so that was the context of the April board meeting where we provided an update on that case. And the board voted to send it over or to refer it to the Attorney General's office on April 3rd, or I believe it was on April 3rd, the Attorney General's office filed a complaint in the Superior Court of Santa Barbara against the Sable Corp. So at that time, at this time, that's where we are. It's in the court's hands. We provided an update for the public because at the April board meeting, the board made it clear that we wanted to make sure the public is aware of what we're doing. And so I wanted to provide an update in our EO report so that the public had an opportunity to provide comment if they wanted to at this time. And I think that's about all I have to say on Sable Court offshore issue at this point. Are there any questions?
I don't think there are questions or comments. Yeah, seeing none. Okay, let's turn this over to public comment, please. May we have 3 minutes? And our first commenter is Jeremy Frankel.
Turn on the mic.
Is your microphone on? I don't see the light. There you go.
I have knocked it off. Do this. Okay. My name is Jeremy Frankel. Thank you. I'm an attorney with the Environmental Defense Center, which is a nonprofit based here in Santa Barbara. I just wanted to take the time today to briefly express our gratitude and that of our clients for the board's diligence in pursuing enforcement action against Sable Offshore. We want to again thank the board for taking the necessary step of referring the matter to the Attorney General's office. I think just too often, entities like Sable ignore the critical laws that this board administers, and they write off any ensuing fines as just the cost of doing business. And we're hopeful that the board's lawsuit will not only prevent Sable from perpetrating any further harm, but deter others like Sable that would willfully disregard this board's directives. And we would also like to specifically call out the efforts of your staff over the past year. Throughout the process, they really actively listened to the concerns of our community here in Santa Barbara, and they conducted their investigation into Sable's activities with really the utmost professionalism. They were incredibly thorough, very timely. So, you know, the board is, I think, very fortunate to have them. And again, just wanted to express our thanks. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment. Our next speaker is Ted Morton.
Good afternoon, Jane Gray and board members. My name is Ted Morton, and I'm the executive director of Santa Barbara Channel Keeper. Today, I also want to thank you for your unanimous vote on April 17 to adopt the resolution to refer the Sable Offshore matter, including the company's disregard of many of the notices of violation for unauthorized waste discharges to Santa Barbara County waters. We're grateful for the commitment of both the staff and the board for your clear actions and diligence to ensure California's important laws to protect water quality and aquatic habitats are upheld. We're pleased to see that the Attorney General has finally stepped in, as your board requested in April, and filed a suit against Sable Offshore for the many violations that they've committed in their efforts to restart the Santa Ynez unit. In the 6 months since the state board's referral to the AG, there's been more activities that are disappointing to our groups and the community of Santa Barbara and their continued efforts to plow forward with their efforts. They misled the public on its activities, incorrectly stating that it had resumed production when in fact it was still conducting testing. It's filed a lawsuit against the County of Santa Barbara for not transferring permits. And I'm sure most of you are aware that next month, the County Board of Supervisors will hold another public hearing on that matter related to transfer permits. Channel Keeper and our community and state partners remain steadfast in our efforts to protect Gaviota Coast and ensure that if this risky restart proceeds, it obtains an environmental review through a transparent public process and is done with the full engagement and oversight of entities like the Central Coast Regional Board. Again, thank you for your leadership on this issue.
Thank you for your comment. I don't have any more public comments at this time. Okay, we've come to the end of our agenda. It's 14:25, and I'm going to close the meeting. Mr. Lodge, do you have anything to say before about our site visit tomorrow? Do you just want to remind the public where we're meeting?
Yeah, we have a site visit at the El Estero Wastewater Treatment Plant and the desalination plant for City of Santa Barbara across the street. That starts at 9 a.m. at the El Estero plant. And we're looking forward to meeting with the city's staff, and they're going to provide a presentation at the beginning, and then we'll do a site walk after that.
Thank you. Okay, I will adjourn this meeting. Thank you very much. Appreciate all the work from AGP and from our staff for being here. Thank you.
Thank you.